You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
Well, this is Jeff Blankford with the January 25th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phone to get your takes on the world. Today, given what has been happening since Donald Trump assumed, or shall we say consumed, presidency 5 days ago, and the massive response to it, I've decided to open the phones after my news and commentary to give you an opportunity to share your thoughts and plans for the Trump era. Listeners to my last program, which took place on the 17th anniversary of my first broadcast of Takes on the World, the 11th of January 2001, didn't get a chance to hear my usual mixture of news and commentary because it coincided with the last 20 minutes of then-President-elect Trump's long-awaited press conference. I plan to begin that commentary by noting what a very different world we are confronted with today than how it was on that other January 11th morning, months before the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, and what they triggered, endless U.S. wars and the spreading of U.S. military forces around the globe. Those wars, it should be noted, produced no significant national protest, but the election of Donald Trump certainly did do that, with hundreds of thousands pouring into the nation's capital on Saturday for a women's march that was far larger than the numbers that appeared the day earlier for Trump's inauguration. Sorry about that, Donald. Similar events took place in cities and towns all over the United States and the world, including Mendocino County, with the largest being in Ukiah, where an estimated 600 women and men gathered at Alex Thomas Plaza before beginning their own march. On my last program, the last part preempted by the Donald, I plan to correct President Lincoln's oft-quoted assessment of the collective wisdom of the country's electorate, which is no less valid today, at least in my mind, than it was 2 weeks ago. Lincoln, you'll recall, said that you can fool all the people some of the time and some of the people all the time, but that you can't fool all the people all the time. Well, that may be true, but in terms of running a country, it's meaningless. There is never a need to fool all the people all the time. Those at the helm of our ship of state or that of any other country understand they just have to fool enough of the people most of the time and have the media on their side to achieve their political agenda. 2 weeks ago, in his last days at the helm, President Obama was still speaking about Russia's alleged hacking and alleged interference in the U.S. elections on Trump's behalf. And enough of the people, particularly the supporters of Hillary Clinton, were buying it, as were key figures within the Republican establishment. The media was with him, and NPR did its part, running a news story almost every hour in Morning Edition, and all things considered, with guests from the Pentagon, Congress, or Washington think tanks. These guests were asked leading questions about the dangers of Russian hacking, the threats of Russian aggression against its eastern neighbors, or its production of so-called fake news, none of which has been substantiated by any hard evidence. What they were producing, in fact, was fake news, as they did during the build-up to the Iraq invasion. Get ready for more of it. That the U.S. might actually have a friendly, non-hostile relationship with Russia under a Trump administration is considered out of the question by elected officials of both parties and their partners in the media, and they are determined to prevent it from happening. On January 19th, the day before the inauguration, Peter Stone and Greg Gordon of the McClatchy Papers Washington Bureau, citing two well-positioned but unnamed individuals familiar with the matter, reported that, quote, "The FBI and five other law enforcement and intelligence agencies have collaborated for months in an investigation into Russian attempts to influence the November election, including whether money from the Kremlin covertly aided President-elect Donald Trump." According to their sources, quote, "The agencies involved in the inquiry are the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, the Justice Department, the Treasury Department's Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, and representatives of the Director of National Intelligence. Investigators, they write, are examining how money may have moved from the Kremlin to covertly help Trump win. One of the allegations involves whether a system for routinely paying thousands of Russian-American pensioners may have been used to pay some emails to the United States or to supply money to intermediaries who then pay the hackers," the two sources said. The informal interagency working group supposedly began to explore possible Russian interference last spring. That would have been well before the FBI received information from a former British spy hired first by a Republican challenger to Trump and then allegedly by the Clinton campaign to develop politically damaging and unverified research about Trump, according to the sources who spoke, quote, on the condition of anonymity due to sensitive nature of the inquiry, end quote. That's a typical way the press describes intentional leaks from a government department, with the leakers never needing to worry about prosecution and how they distribute what's called fake news. On January 6th, James Clapper, the director of national intelligence, had released a declassified report that concluded Russian President Vladimir Putin had ordered an influence campaign to, quote, undermine faith in the U.S. democratic process, end quote, damage Hillary Clinton's election prospects, and bolster Trump's. That campaign, we are told, included the hacking of top Democrats' emails and fake news distributed by Russian sources. No examples of the fake news I mentioned have been forthcoming, unless one considers the whole story to be an American variety of fake news. Trump, after strongly denying the allegations and ridiculing the intelligence agencies and apparently under pressure, acknowledged that Russia was involved with the hacking, but called allegations that he or his associates were involved in a political witch hunt and, quote, and complete and total fabrication, end quote. Trump said yesterday that FBI Director James Comey will be retained. It was Comey's press conferences on Clinton's irresponsible use of a private email server while Secretary of State, and most notably one he gave the Friday before the election that dealt with the contents of former Congressman Anthony Weiner's laptop that produced nothing of substance, that was initially blamed for Clinton's defeat. That story had more legs on it, but less political value than blaming it on the Russians and on Vladimir Putin in particular. Comey and the rest of Trump's newly appointed intelligence and law enforcement chiefs will continue the investigation, whose outcome, writes the McClatchy reporters, could create national and international fallout. Well, that's putting it mildly. The only doubt about the agency's initial report that I found in the mainstream media was expressed midway in an article by the New York Times' Scott Shane, who followed a blistering attack on the Russian role in the elections with a sudden change of direction, informing Times readers that, quote, what is missing from the public report is what many Americans most eagerly anticipated, hard evidence to back up the agency's claims that the Russian government engineered the election attack. That is a significant omission, wrote Shane. Quote, he says, there is only a whisper of dissent in the report. The eavesdroppers of the NSA believe, with only, quote, moderate confidence, end quote, that Russia aimed to help Trump, or their colleagues at the CIA and the FBI have, quote, unquote, high confidence. For anyone seriously following the American political scene, the conclusions drawn by the intelligence agencies at the end of the day made me miss the TV presence and commentaries of Jon Stewart. Here they are. Russia's goals were to undermine public faith in the U.S. democratic process, denigrate Secretary Clinton, and harm her electability and potential presidency, it said. We further assess Putin and the Russian government developed a clear preference for President-elect Trump, end quote. Well, poll after poll has shown that without Russia's involvement, Americans have lost faith in our political system and the so-called democratic process, with ratings for Congress in the single digits. This was widely understood to be one of the key reasons for the success not only of Trump, but of Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primaries. The difference, of course, was that the media was as determined to ignore the growing public support for the Vermont senator as it was in publicizing that for Trump. That the intelligence services believed they needed an investigation to conclude that Trump was a choice of Putin and the Russians, and then stressed the importance of that finding, is equally ludicrous. Not only had Clinton compared Putin to Hitler after Russia's annexation of Crimea while supporting an expansion of NATO to Russia's borders, she was determined to establish a no-fly zone over Syria to challenge the Russian Air Force's support for the Syrian government, which would have inevitably led to a military confrontation with Moscow. Putin, no doubt, also saw her hand in the U.S.-sponsored coup in Ukraine that had been orchestrated by her former press spokeswoman, Victoria Nuland, who Obama had subsequently appointed to be Deputy Secretary of State for Europe and Asia. Had Clinton been elected, Nuland was expected to be appointed to a top security post. Of course, Putin and the Russians would have wanted no part of Clinton. It was just common sense on their part. We didn't need the CIA, the FBI, or NSA to tell us that. Well, when it comes to interfering in our elections and political processes, of course, no country holds a candle to Israel. Israel's interference in the American political structure has been going on for so long that the high-profile activities of its American agents are taken for granted. Consequently, when President Obama had America's UN ambassador, Samantha Power, abstain from a UN Security Council resolution condemning Israel's illegal settlements in the West Bank, which affirms a long-standing U.S. and UN attitude toward those Jewish-only towns and villages, the president was lambasted by members of Congress from both political parties, and the obliging media acted as if that criticism was to be expected. Even the calls and tweets by Senators Lindsey Graham, Ted Cruz, and Marco Rubio to end U.S. funding for the United Nations until and unless Security Council reversed its vote on the resolution were not seen as at all out of the question. The Israeli-occupied House of Representatives was just as eager to prove its loyalty to Israel when, by a 342-80 vote, it passed a resolution calling for the repeal of the Security Council resolution. I was pleased to see that our representative, Jared Huffman, voted against it, as did Dianne Feinstein, who was the only senator, as far as I was able to tell, to issue a statement supporting the abstention. Not surprisingly, the national media did not seek her out for an interview. A bipartisan group of senators, including Republican Party leader Mitch McConnell and his Democratic counterpart, the new Senate Minority Leader Charles Schumer from New York, are backing a similar measure condemning the Security Council's action. Schumer's actions are not unexpected, since he once told a Jewish radio station in New York City that his last name, Schomer, meant defender of the ghetto in Europe. Schumer, now the Senate's most powerful Democrat, said he sees himself as a defender of Israel, which is not hard in that body, which, given the Senate's voting record in recent decades, is apparently part of the job description for senators in all the 50 states. The attacks on the administration are, quote, betraying Israel or, quote, stabbing her in the back, as the Washington Post's Charles Krauthammer, among others, described it, continued when Secretary of State Kerry made a speech the following day describing the administration's ongoing frustration with Prime Minister Netanyahu's efforts to destroy any chance of a Palestinian state arising from the West Bank. Under the headline, quote, Kerry's blunt words for Israel are denounced by lawmakers in both parties, the New York Times gave full voice to Kerry's critics, with Senator John McCain best exemplifying Congress's passion and attachment for the Jewish state, calling Kerry's remarks, quote, another dangerous outburst that will further Israel's diplomatic isolation and embolden its enemies, end quote. For those who still believe that the war in Iraq was for oil and not for Israel, as conceived and orchestrated by the Project for New American Century, the pro-Israel neocon front, whose co-founders Robert Kagan and were counting on a Clinton victory, Paris-based journalist Diana Johnstone, a guest on this program, reminds us that, quote, if U.S. foreign policy were run to satisfy the big oil companies, the nomination of the chief of Exxon as Secretary of State would have been confirmed in 5 minutes. Instead, the hearings drag on for days of hostile grilling by senators, end quote. Just yesterday, Senator Marco Rubio reluctantly cast the deciding vote in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee to give ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson an 11-10 margin of approval and move his nomination to the full Senate, where he was sure to be confirmed despite opposition from Democratic senators. This is far from being a new situation, of course. Many of you remember Senator J.W. Fulbright, the Arkansas Democrat who was a critic of the Vietnam War. After he left office, having been the first U.S. senator targeted for defeat by AIPAC, Israel's official lobby, he wrote that, quote, for many years I have felt that that the situation in the Middle East was very nearly hopeless. The fundamental problem for us is that we have lost our freedom of action in the Middle East and are committed to policies that promote neither our own national interest nor the cause of peace. AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, and its allied organizations have effective working control of the electoral process. Quote from Fulbright, they can elect or defeat nearly any congressman or senator that they wish with their money and coordinated organization, end quote. And that's even more true today than when Fulbright wrote it more than a half a century ago. Well, what had been Fulbright's crime in AIPAC's eyes? That as chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he had held hearings in 1963, which revealed that Israel was funneling tax-exempt contributions made by Jewish Americans to Israel back to the American Zionist Council, AIPAC's original name, to pay for pro-Israel propaganda in the United States, which was against the law. Moreover, the hearings produced plans by the American Zionist Council to infiltrate every critical sector of American society to propagandize them on Israel's behalf, in a sense, to become a fifth column. As a result of these hearings, President Kennedy authorized the Foreign Agents Registration Agency of the Justice Department to make the American Zionist Council register as what it was, an agency of a foreign government. The efforts of the Justice Department were resisted with vigor by the AZC's attorneys until the assassination of President Kennedy in Dallas in November made the issue moot. The very pro-Israel Lyndon Johnson brought in Nicholas Katzenbach to replace Bobby Kennedy's attorney general. The American Zionist Council became the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, and the Justice Department's attempt to rein in Israel's American agents was allowed to die. An effort to resuscitate the Justice Department's original registration order, backed by more than 300 pages of documents, was attempted several years ago by Grant Smith, director of IRMIP, the Washington-based Institute for Research in Middle East Policy, a frequent guest on this program. But the lobby's apparent hold over the Justice Department turned out to be as tight as its grip on our Congress. Smith's book, Foreign Agents, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, from the 1963 Fulbright hearings to the 2005 espionage scandal, is a definitive and only book on the subject and can be ordered online, as can his latest, quote, Big Israel, How Israel's Lobby Moves America, which supplies the details about the proliferation of tax-exempt organizations whose fundraising for Israel the media ignores. I've interviewed Grant about the subject as well as about Fulbright's hearings, but the subjects are considered taboo by even the leading alternative media. The U.S., of course, is not the only country in which pro-Israel lobbies pressure their governments to put Israel's interests first. 2 weeks ago, an Al Jazeera undercover investigation revealed that Shai Massat, a member of the Israeli embassy staff in the United Kingdom, was working with senior politicians from the Conservative and Labour parties to undermine their own party's politicians and shape British foreign policy to benefit Israel rather than British interests. Once, writes Nazareth-based journalist Jonathan Cook, no one would have hesitated to call British politicians acting in the interest of a foreign power and very possibly taking financial benefits for doing so traitors. And yet, as the secretly filmed footage reveals, he says, Israeli agents like Shai Massat can readily meet and conspire with a Tory minister's much trusted aide to discuss how best to, quote, take down, end quote, the deputy foreign minister, Alan Duncan, over his criticism of Israel's illegal settlements. The video shows an assistant to Britain's education minister suggesting that, quote, a little scandal be engineered to damage Duncan, who in 2008 became the British Parliament's first openly gay member. The Israeli embassy, trying to minimize the damage, described Massat as a contract employee who was being sent home while the British Foreign Office announced that the case had been closed. Imagine if Massat had been Russian or Palestinian. This has been Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next.
This Week in Palestine.
This رحلة تمتطيني قوساق زحف طفلة تمتطيني قوساق زحف.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is so important that we present it each week on Truth and Justice Radio. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. Well, here they are at it again. The Massachusetts Jewish lobbies, with JCRC at the helm, are trying to again pass legislation that will attack the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. Unsuccessful last term, the lobby is again trying with stealth anti-discrimination legislation that does not mention BDS or boycott, but would allow the targeting of the BDS movement. The bill, framed as an anti-discrimination bill, looks innocuous. It is not. An alert was sent out by the Alliance for Water Justice in Palestine to its supporters and members of a large coalition of organizations that have coalesced to counter the attacks on BDS. The alert reads in part, "Dear Alliance supporters, Massachusetts leaders are trying to take away our right to boycott again. State Senator Cream of Newton has filed SB 922, a bill that would penalize supporters of the Palestinian Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions BDS movement for justice, as well as other social movements that employ time-honored tactics of economic pressure. The House bill is submitted by Representative Paul McMurtry, is House Bill 779. It is the same bill. Call your senator and state representative immediately to ask that they oppose this dangerous bill. This isn't just about our state Senate. This is not just a formality or an isolated attack. It is not even just about Palestine. This amendment is a piece of a coordinated right-wing attack on our right to organize for justice, period. As Trump and Republican lawmakers attempt to criminalize dissent in Washington, we will not allow free speech suppression in Massachusetts. With so many people taking to the streets right now fighting for justice, equity, and democracy, it is more important than ever to resist any and all attacks on our movements." Senator Cream's bill is framed as anti-discrimination legislation when in reality it forbids the state from contracting with institutions and individuals who boycott companies that profit off the Israeli occupation and policies of apartheid. If Senator Cream had introduced this bill in 1975, it would have made activism against South African apartheid substantially more difficult. Recall in July 2016 when Senator Cream tried to sneak an anti-boycott amendment into the Economic Development Bill. We happened to be doing our water information delivery to the legislators, and along with Massachusetts Peace Action and Jewish Voice for Peace, mobilized so quickly that she withdrew the amendment on the very same day. We can stop it again. We need you to call. Call your senator and state representative now and ask that they oppose the bill. Nearly 100 Massachusetts organizations have signed a statement opposing any legislation that impedes the right to boycott. That includes groups representing Muslims, Christians, Jews, American Indians, students, professors, labor unions, lawyers, and LGBTQ communities, as well as advocates on human rights, peace and justice, anti-racism, housing, criminal justice reform, corporate accountability, civil liberties, and climate change. We're part of a team led by Massachusetts Peace Action and Jewish Voice for Peace. Tell your senator, thousands of progressives throughout Massachusetts oppose this type of attack on our movement for Palestinian human rights. That was an excerpt from an alert sent out by the Alliance for Water Justice in Palestine to mobilize opposition to the newly filed anti-boycott bills in the Massachusetts legislature. Now, before the legislation gains traction, is the time to lobby your legislators. And now on to our feature presentation, which this week is part two of the interview with British journalist Jonathan Cook, who lives and writes from Nazareth, a predominantly Palestinian Arab city in the north of Israel. To hear part one, if you are so inclined, please find it in our archive, which you can access on the internet at truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and then click on This Week in Palestine Archives. This interview is about 10 years old and was done on the occasion of Jonathan Cook's publication of his book, Blood and Religion, The Unmasking of the Jewish and Democratic State. But it continues to resonate because he goes into great detail describing the plight of Palestinians who live in the State of Israel and constitute some 20% of Israel's citizens. We left off last week with his description of problems Palestinian Arabs have in finding professional work in Israel where they live. Although the Palestinian population is highly educated, finding work as a professional, a doctor, engineer, lawyer, or academic, is close to impossible. We pick up at the point where Jonathan Cook observes that much of the purpose of this is to make life difficult for Israeli Arabs so that they will leave. That is where we pick up the interview this morning.
It's hard not to interpret some of these policies, certainly those Israeli policies imposed in the occupied territories and also those imposed on Palestinian Israelis, to interpret these policies as a deliberate effort to drive Palestinians out, to force them to see their future as professionals, as academics, as lawyers or doctors, to see their future outside of Israel,
exactly.
To leave the country, to go somewhere else, to go to Europe or go to the United States.
Well, I'll give you a good example. There's been a campaign here among the Palestinian citizens of Israel for many decades to create Israel's first Arab university, teaching in the Arabic language. It's never been allowed. Israel has always made sure that it wouldn't happen. Now, there are good reasons why it doesn't want an Arab university. It would help create this professional class, this leadership that would help organize Palestinians inside Israel, give them new vision, new understanding. What happens instead is that if you don't want to go to an Israeli university where you're going to have to be taught in Hebrew, which is your second language, and it immediately puts you at a disadvantage against Israeli Jewish pupils, who are your students, who you're competing with, your options are to go to Jordan, for instance, and go to one of the universities there, which a lot of Palestinian students now do. They go to Jordan and they study at one of the universities in Amman. Now, once they finish that education, there's a good chance they meet somebody there, maybe a Jordanian, and maybe they think to get married. And there's a good chance that they won't come back And that's exactly how Israel likes it. And you'll see that in all sorts of policies that are here, which encourage people to leave. One of the few political parties, dissenting non-Zionist political parties that were allowed inside Israel was the Communist Party. It was mainly because in its early days, the Jewish community was the organizers and leaders of the Communist Party inside Israel. So it was difficult to ban it. But one of the benefits for Israel in terms of its Palestinian community was that the Communist Party used to give grants to Palestinians to go and study. Most Palestinian intellectuals here could not get to an Israeli university. The restrictions were too severe. So if you wanted to get an education as a doctor, as a dentist, as a lawyer, some of the main trades that are allowed here, as I said, the service industries, what would typically happen is that you would apply, you would join the Communist Party here, and then apply for a scholarship. And often people got scholarships. A number of people I know here who speak East European language. I mean, all sorts of languages, Moldovan, Hungarian, Russian. And that's because they studied and trained in the communist bloc, in the Soviet bloc. Now, many of them didn't come back. They married a Moldovan or Hungarian, and they stayed there. And again, Israel was quite happy with that arrangement and encouraged it. And it was one of the reasons it made it so difficult for, one, I mean, there are many reasons, but one of the reasons it made it so difficult for Palestinian citizens to get to Israeli universities, as is still the case. It's still extremely difficult for them to get to universities and still underrepresented there.
What are some of the other elements of the conflict that you address in your book?
I think the other really important issue, which we haven't mentioned so far, is and it's a key question for Israel, again, both sides of the Green Line, is the question of demography, the question of numbers, who has the larger number of people. And that's been a Zionist obsession, as we know, since before 1948. It was one of the driving forces for the whole program of ethnic cleansing that was carried out in 1948, because Israel, to be a Jewish state, needs a very strong Jewish majority. Otherwise, it doesn't have the legitimacy. If it's kind of 50% Palestinians, 50% Jews, difficult to sell that idea of a Jewish state as a legitimate idea. So Israel has been working assiduously for many decades to ensure that demographically it's in control, that it has the higher numbers. Now, one of the questions that I look at in the book is this whole problem of the numbers game for Israel. One of the things that Ehud Olmert mentioned in November 2003 in an interview in Haaretz, shortly before Ariel Sharon announced the disengagement, in an interview he said, the biggest threat to us, I'm paraphrasing him here, but the biggest threat to us would be if the Palestinians start a campaign, a struggle for one man, one vote, just as the blacks did in South Africa under apartheid, because this would look like a legitimate struggle. And that would be dangerous to us as a Jewish state. And it's not insignificant that a month later, Ariel Sharon mentioned for the first time at the Herzliya conference his idea for disengagement from Gaza, because the two ideas are intimately linked. The disengagement from Gaza, and this is one of the major arguments I make in the book, was entirely a demographic move. It was a way of buying time for the state, just as demographers inside Israel were warning that the numbers of Palestinians and Jews were reaching parity, that within ten years, there would be a similar number of Jews and Palestinians inside the greater Israel area. It was at that point that Sharon was sold on the idea of the disengagement. Gaza had never been particularly important to the Zionist dream. It had a large number of Palestinians, 1.4 million of them. By getting rid of them, severing them off from the greater Israel dream, he immediately bought Israel a couple of decades to sort out its other demographic problems, which was Palestinians inside Israel and also the Palestinians in the West Bank. So, and I think it's important to realize that the demographic threat is seen to be as much inside Israel, if not more inside Israel, than it is in the occupied territories. This is often overlooked. And Israel has been working very carefully over the last few years to manage the demographic problem inside Israel. And that's where we're seeing the new ideas, like the Lieberman ideas, about transferring the population from inside Israel into the occupied territories. And one of the major arguments I'm making in the book is that the disengagement and the idea of convergence, which has now been put on hold, but effectively it's happening anyway because the West Bank wall is still being built. I mean, that's the new line, political line, Israel is creating. Well, what's the significance of that political line? And I think the significance of it is that Israel will create some kind of series of ghettos which it will then want the international community to call a Palestinian state. And it will then say, well, that is the place where the Palestinians have their right to recognition and to exercise their sovereign rights. That is a Palestinian state. If you want to be a Palestinian, go to that Palestinian state. And that's basically Lieberman's argument. His argument is, if you want to be a Palestinian and you're a citizen of Israel, well, then you have to renounce your citizenship and go and live in that Palestinian state. That's the whole concept of this transfer of the Little Triangle, this area that's very close to the West Bank, which he wants to be moved in on the other side of the wall, so it will become effectively part of this Palestinian state, this pseudo-Palestinian state that they're talking about. They're also talking about the idea that if you want to demand a state of all its citizens, which is seen as treasonous and subversive, that will become an illegitimate political platform inside Israel. It already, in fact, is an illegitimate platform. It's not possible as a political party to stand here and demand or to not acknowledge Israel as a Jewish and democratic state. It hasn't been enforced yet, but that is the law. So at some point we can assume that Israel will start enforcing that. But what people are talking about is loyalty oaths. And I think that's what's likely to for the rest of the Palestinian community inside Israel to face quite soon will be these loyalty oaths. You will have to pledge allegiance to Israel as a Jewish and democratic state, which will negate any claims you might have to Israel being a state of all its citizens. That's the way you negate that threat. You say, well, if you want to live inside Israel and be a Palestinian, you have to acknowledge that Israel is a Jewish and democratic state, and you can't challenge that. And if you want to, then you have to go and live in this pseudo-Palestinian state we're creating next door. I think that's the game plan. How soon it will be realized, how effectively, is difficult to say. But that's the vision that emerged. I think that's the Sharon vision. It's the Olmert vision. And I think it's also the army's vision. And that's what we're seeing being created at the moment, a series of ghettos which will be called a Palestinian state. They'll be behind a series of walls and fences. And if you want to be a Palestinian inside Israel, then you're going to have to say, okay, well, my Palestinian identity is just a kind of symbolic identity. It doesn't have any real meaning. And I pledge allegiance to Israel as a Jewish and democratic state, which, in other words, I have to pledge allegiance to a state which discriminates against me, which doesn't recognize me as an equal to a Jewish citizen. And that's going to put Palestinians inside Israel in a very difficult situation. They're going to be faced with a choice of either accepting their second or third class status inside Israel permanently, or leaving the state, going and living in a state which is, as we've seen in Gaza, even after the withdrawal of the settlers and of the army, it's no kind of life, it's no kind of statehood. It's a prison, a very large prison. And I don't think many Palestinian citizens of Israel are going to opt for that choice. So they're effectively going to have to buy into their second or third class citizenship. And I think that's a clever move by Israel, and it might well be bought by the international community.
I'd like to ask about countertrends.
Yeah.
The description of these Bantustans, the strategy being imposed on the West Bank, it's not something new. We have the recent history of South Africa as a precedent, as a guide to where this may lead. What do you see as the countertrends, the reservoirs of hope, that another direction might be possible for the people of the region?
Well, unfortunately, I'm not great on hope. I will do my best, though. I think one has to recognize that all regimes learn from their predecessors' mistakes, and I have no doubt there were very close ties between Israel and apartheid South Africa, and I have no doubt that Israel has learned the lessons from apartheid South Africa's failure, and it will not repeat them exactly. It will change the format and the implementation enough. It hopes that it can, that the international community will buy it, and that's really what matters, or Americans will buy it, the American regime will buy it, which is what really counts. So I think there's that first obstacle, I mean, that anybody who opposes what's going on faces, is that Israel isn't going to be stupid and just replicate apartheid South Africa. It's going to do it more cleverly. And so we're going to have to be more clever in our arguments. The second thing is that we have an obstacle which the opponents of apartheid South Africa didn't have, which is that if we criticize Israel, we're called anti-Semites. That's a very powerful argument. It's a very powerful argument for most people. And it's a big problem. You know, if you opposed apartheid South Africa, what did people call you? You know, they didn't have a word for it. I mean, if you supported the rights of the black people of South Africa, in general, that was seen as a good thing. It helped also that America has a large black community population, and so you had support on your side if you were fighting for the rights of the black population of South Africa. Now, the problem in America is almost reversed, where you have a large, or not maybe such a large community, but you have a significant, influential Jewish community who, in the main, are quite supportive of Israel. Not on everything, but still fairly supportive. And so the power balance is rather different, I think, in this case. And it's much harder to argue your case. There aren't so many Palestinians inside America, and those that there are tend to keep their heads down rather than out there arguing vociferously for the rights of the Palestinians in the occupied territories. So I think we should be aware of those hurdles, those obstacles, and not suggest that it's going to be, the fight is as easy as it was in the case of apartheid South Africa. What hope is there? I think there's always the hope that that anyone arguing for and campaigning for universal rights and for justice, you know, you have right on your side. It's a powerful argument, and as long as it's heard, I think you can make a significant dent in a significant impression on people. I mean, I think there is also maybe a third element to this, a third obstacle which I haven't mentioned also, which is the American media, which is not very supportive or very realistic about what's going on here, and is part of the problem as well, because it prevents ordinary Americans from really hearing what's going on. So that's another obstacle that has to be confronted. But as long as we can make ourselves heard, we can make people realize what the issues are and what's going on, there is the hope that message will be understood and will be powerful, because we're talking about universal rights here. We're talking about Palestinians having the same rights as Israeli Jews. So that's one small ray of hope. I think the other hope is that Israeli Jews are starting to realize that Palestinians, I mean, there's been a process for the Israeli Jewish population here. They've undergone a series of stages of recognition of the Palestinians, which may be difficult for us to imagine that they would have been able to, for instance, recognize the idea of a Palestinian state 20 or 30 years ago. People didn't talk in those terms. I mean, I have Israeli Jewish friends, older ones, who remember a time when it was just not possible to talk about Palestinians ever having a state. Well, it is possible to talk about that now. I don't think it's very realistic. Most Israeli Jews' understanding of what might be needed to create a Palestinian state isn't very realistic yet, but at least they've made that kind of mental leap, and that's a first stage. I think the communities, the small groups I was talking about earlier, like Zohrot, and there are other ones, Tayush is another one, important one. These small groups are very active, they're very vociferous, and they're very committed, and they are slowly starting to make an impression. There was a lot of hostility, for instance, as I mentioned to Zohrot, when they first started their activities. But in general, I've noticed, and I know from Etin Bronstein, who's the director of Zohrot, that there's a large number of Jews who are at least curious about what they're doing. Maybe not approving of it, but curious. Not immediately hostile. When he first started doing these signposting projects in the destroyed villages, he was just met with hostility, and sometimes with physical violence. Now, more often, there's a curiosity. There's a sense of, who are you? What are you doing? Why are you doing it? And that's a change, and it's an important change, and it's the beginning of a process of understanding. It leads somewhere hopeful. And that's, to me, the small sign of hope that I cling to, that if Israeli Jews can start to want to know why somebody might want to put a signpost up with an Arabic name on it, that's a beginning. And it's a small one, but it's a beginning, and it could lead to something significant. So that's maybe the hope I can offer, but I appreciate it's not a huge one.
You've spoken a little about the United States, the main benefactor of the State of Israel. Could you talk about the United States' role in influencing the direction of events here?
Yeah, it's a difficult question. It's a particularly difficult question maybe for me to answer. I'm not American. I'm British. And I live in Israel and have been for the last 5 years. So I tend to see things from this end rather than... I read a lot about what's going on in America. But again, it's not my personal knowledge that I'm drawing on here. It's my impressions from reading the media. I think that... we're in a state of flux right now. I think Americans are in a state of flux about the whole Middle East. I mean, there are big questions being opened up. Really, Israel had a little comfortable monopoly on what was going on here in terms of our understanding. You know, Israeli soldiers were the ones that died in wars against the Arabs, and so it was difficult to question what Israel was doing, and they were the ones suffering, so who are we to tell them what to be doing? But that's not true anymore. I mean, there are lots of Americans, as we know, dying and being injured in Iraq, not so far away, and the question is, why are they there and what are they achieving, and is there a connection between that and Israel? Israel was one of the big cheerleaders of the invasion of Iraq. I mean, I was here at the time, and I remember how there was almost uniform support for the idea of invading Iraq. And we know that neoconservatives, who have a strong affinity with Israel, were also key movers behind the whole idea of invading Iraq. So I think that these kind of questions are starting to be raised for the first time in America. People are asking, what's Israel's role in the Middle East? What's it trying to achieve? And how does that relate to us in America and our involvement in the Middle East now? And as we've seen with this recent paper by Walton Mearsheimer, some significant people in American intellectual world, and I think we're starting to see the beginnings of people raising issues about what is American foreign policy in the Middle East doing, what's it trying to achieve, and who's pushing for what. So I think there are questions being raised. I mean, it's clear to me, even from here, I can see that Americans are... There is a movement there. People start to question what's going on and whether Israel is playing fair in the Middle East. You know, whether the connection... There is a connection, as we've also seen with this recent Hamilton Baker report as well. Question of how connected are the questions of what's happening to the Palestinians and wider issues and problems America's facing in the Middle East, hostility. So I think that Israel hasn't got a monopoly on wisdom anymore. It isn't controlling the debate, and that's going to become harder and harder for it to do. The debate is going to start widening out, and other people are going to start having their voice heard. And that's only a healthy... I think that's only a healthy thing. How quickly it'll happen, I don't know, though.
Let's talk about the sort of issues that typically have a tremendous influence on how many people view the conflict here in Palestine, Israel. I wonder if we could talk about the Qassam rockets that are currently being fired from Gaza into Israeli communities near the border. Certainly when these issues are reported in the United States, they are typically placed within the context of Israel's struggle to provide security for its people.
Yeah. So
just within the last week, and we're speaking on December 28th, two Israeli teenagers were very seriously injured by a Qassam rocket that struck the town of Sidrot. How do you talk about these incidents and the violent resistance that is a part of the resistance against the Israeli occupation?
Sure. Well, I think there are two ways of looking at that issue. I mean, one, and I think it's an important one to remember, and one that tends to be ignored in the States, I think, is that actually the Palestinians do have a right under international law to resist the occupation, and they can resist it violently. We can then have a debate about what's sensible resistance or what's productive resistance and what's harming their cause. And that's largely a matter of perception often, and that's something that the Palestinians don't have a lot of control over. That's how their resistance is framed by, for instance, the international media and the American media. So, I want to make the first point that, of course, the Palestinians do have a right to resist the occupation, and it's important to remember that, not to forget it. But I think there is a question, a valid question about how productive, how useful, how successful the armed resistance has been. That's a question that I think Palestinians have been having through the Intifada. They've been seriously considering how successful has an armed Intifada been. And I think we tend to assume that the lull in suicide attacks is a reflection of the building of the wall. I actually think that's a major mistake. I think that was it's actually a conscious decision by the Palestinians. What people possibly abroad don't realize is that the wall is far from finished, and there are major gaps in it, including in Jerusalem still, so that any suicide bomber who wants to get into Israel still pretty much can. I mean, if you're determined to get into Israel, and we can assume suicide bombers are pretty determined, they can get in. So the question is, why have there been such a drop in the number of attacks? And I think that's a conscious choice by many of the Palestinian factions to stop the suicide bombings. I think they realized they weren't being helpful to the Palestinian cause. And we tend to just assume it's because entry to Israel has been blocked. I think that's far too simplistic a view of what's been going on. So there is a debate within Palestinian society about what to do. But I think maybe the most important point, which is usually neglected, is that most of the time Palestinians are resisting in non-violent ways to the occupation, and it's almost entirely ignored. When they resist non-violently, nobody notices. Which is one of the reasons I think that the Intifada turned so violent, was because Palestinians realized that unless they were violent, nobody really noticed. Nobody took note. The media didn't turn up. One of the most high-profile, but still not very high-profile, acts of resistance that has been happening every Friday for more than a year now has been in a small village called Bilin, where Israel is building a wall on Palestinian land, annexing farmland from that village and destroying any hope of the livelihoods of the people who live there. Now, there's been demonstrations, non-violent demonstrations there every Friday for more than a year, attended by local Palestinians, by international solidarity activists, and by Israelis, both Palestinian citizens and Israeli Jews. That's had virtually no coverage. There's very little coverage of that. And it's significant because those non-violent demonstrations have been greeted by the Israeli army with violence. What's been happened to those demonstrators is that they've regularly faced rubber bullets, some live ammunition. People have been shot, injured. They've been using experimental crowd control techniques, which has been covered by the Israeli media. I mean, the Israeli media have written quite extensively about this, but you very rarely see anything written in the international media or American media about this. So that's a high-profile example of non-violent resistance. But of course, there are small examples of that going on all the time. Just the struggle that Palestinians make every day to go to their schools or their universities or hospitals, these are forms of non-violent resistance, the occupation, because the occupation is all about stopping them doing these things. These 500-plus checkpoints that exist all over the West Bank are designed to stop Palestinians leading normal lives, to going to school or university or to hospital or getting to the market to buy things or to sell produce. So just turning up at the checkpoint and refusing to be intimidated by it is a form of non-violent resistance. But, of course, it gets no coverage whatsoever. So I think, in a way, the whole question of resistance has become a trap for the Palestinians. If they resist in non-violent ways, nobody notices, nobody cares, and Israel wins. And if they resist violently, then everybody condemns them and calls them savages and barbarians. So really they can't win on that argument. I think the whole question, which is why it brings us back to the question of what are their rights under international law? Well, their rights under international law are that they have the right to resist the occupation in any way they choose, which is violently or non-violently. Obviously they should be resisting insofar as they can, in ways that target military facilities, soldiers, and so on. But it's interesting, when they do that as well, they get condemned. When they captured a soldier who was at a military post just on the borders of Gaza, firing part of an artillery battery that was firing into into Gaza, and therefore an entirely legitimate military target. When they captured that soldier, Gilad Shalit, Gilad Shalit has become this kind of poster boy for those who kind of want to argue that that the Palestinians are not behaving in legitimate ways. Is being used by the politicians to justify the sanctions that have been imposed on the Palestinians. I mean, it's become a kind of contributing factor to an argument that was already being made against Hamas and its election. So I think all in these kind of ways that the Palestinians can't win, and I think that's the way the whole thing is set up, so they can't win. Israel and America have kind of engineered the debate, the argument, in such a way that whatever the Palestinians do, they're playing foul. And I think it's important that we highlight that all the time as well. There is no way that the Palestinians can behave which is going to encourage Israel to start saying, yes, these are people we can negotiate with, or to say, oh, yeah, okay, Hamas can do the right thing. I think that's one of the reasons why the Palestinians have ended up with a Hamas government, because they've tried the route of collaboration. Fatah was renowned for helping Israel. I mean, even some of its senior figures were involved in selling cement to the Israelis to build the wall. I mean, there's some rather unpleasant, unsavory episodes involving Fatah, which ordinary Palestinians were very aware of. It didn't matter that Fatah was playing Israel's game. Israel still didn't move towards creating any kind of Palestinian state. So I think Palestinians realized that there was no point even in staying with their political leaders who were prepared to collaborate or prepared to go easy on Israel. They decided to play tough, and Hamas was the natural choice for them. Now we're condemning them because they've made that choice, but we're the ones who forced them into making that choice, because we didn't do anything, we didn't encourage them, we didn't give them any prizes or awards for doing what we wanted them to do, or said we wanted them to do. And I'm using we here, rather. But, you know, I think that the international community has to take responsibility for the election of Hamas. Hamas is a sign that the Palestinians are fed up with being lied to, fed up with being mistreated, and that they're no longer prepared to play ball in that kind of way.
That was an interview with British journalist Jonathan Cook, who lives and writes from Nazareth. And finally, how are Palestinians reacting to the inauguration of Donald Trump? We turn to Palestinian journalist Shireen Khalel, based in Ramallah, who writes the following in Mondo Weiss. As Americans gather across the country in a mixture of celebration and protest following the inauguration of U.S. President Donald Trump, Palestinians in the occupied territory are expressing their own concerns of what a Trump presidency will mean for them. As Trump made his inaugural speech in Washington, a handful of youth leaders gathered by the separation wall in the occupied West Bank district of Bethlehem, lighting images of Trump on fire and posting up banners with messages such as, "Move your embassy to your own country, not ours," and "Stop Trump. Jerusalem is the capital of Palestine." Naji Odeh, director of Palestinian Youth Action Center for Community Development, was in attendance, and he told Mondo Weiss that while he does not think Trump will be good for Palestinian politics, he does not see a Trump administration as being drastically better or worse for Palestine than the Obama administration had been or what the Hillary Clinton administration could have been. "I think they are all very similar," Odeh said. "Trump's stance will be in the same political direction. He can't completely change everything the way he says he can. He says the things he says for the media. Yes, Trump will certainly support Israel, but Obama did too." One point Odeh is concerned with is Trump's promise to move the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. both Palestinians and Israelis strive to make Jerusalem their own capital, and because of the contentious nature of the city's status, many states, as well as the United Nations, support Jerusalem having an international status and do not recognize the city as the capital of either communities. In 1995, the Jerusalem Embassy Act was passed by the 104th U.S. Congress. The act stated that by 1998, the U.S. Embassy in Israel would be moved to Jerusalem and that the city would be declared an undivided capital of Israel. However, U.S. Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama opposed the act as an infringement on the presidential office's authority over foreign policy, consistently overriding the bill. Odeh said he feels confident that Trump will go through on his promise to transfer the embassy to Jerusalem, though he's not sure on the time frame such a move would take place. I think he will succeed in moving the embassy because, really, who can say no to him when it comes to that? Even the Palestinian Authority will eventually accept the move, he said. It's so easy for the American president to move an embassy. The Palestinian Authority doesn't need to agree with it, and in the end, the Palestinian Authority receives orders and they don't react. Now, the international community won't support them, but they will say it is an American issue and escape from responsibility. If he does move the embassy, there will be outrage, but the action will come from the people, not governments, and not just in Palestine, he added. On Thursday, Trump reportedly reiterated his stance on the embassy move to the Israel Hayyim Hebrew language daily, telling a reporter that, "You know that I'm not a person who breaks promises." Mustafa Barghouti, a member of the Palestinian Parliament and Secretary General of the Palestinian National Initiative, agreed that in general the United States stance on the Palestinian-Israeli conflict does not change much regardless of who is president. But he is concerned by some of Trump's statements regarding the American embassy being moved to Jerusalem, as well as appointment of David Friedman, an Orthodox Jewish bankruptcy lawyer, who has voiced his support for the annexation and Israeli settlement of the West Bank. There have certainly been signals that have come from the Trump camp that are very alarming, including the threat to move the American embassy to Jerusalem and the talks that came out of his administration about Israel's illegal settlements not being an obstacle to peace, as well as statements about annexing parts of the West Bank to Israel, Barghouti said. And there were certain statements made by Mr. Friedman that are alarming. His appointment itself is alarming. What we hope is that the strong reactions of the international community concerning the embassy move will be enough to convince Mr. Trump not to commit such a major mistake, he said. When asked if he thought some of the statements made by Trump's administration could cause a popular Palestinian uprising on the ground, Barghouti said there is already a threat of another Palestinian uprising without the contention brought to the table by Trump. Israel is fueling sparks for a new intifada through its crimes every day, Barghouti said. The main instigator in a new intifada would certainly be Israel and its behavior, but moving the embassy to Jerusalem will absolutely spark flames, not only here, but worldwide. A move like this is not something small that would be forgotten in a week or so. It's a major political move, and it would mean the U.S. is nullifying its position of being a partner in the peace process. George Abu Eid, 25, and a history and science teacher from the West Bank with a degree in political science, called Trump a racist, bigot, xenophobic narcissist, but told Mondawais that, in a way, he's happy a person with Trump's personality has taken control of the American presidency. For Palestinians like myself, who have been following up and observing the U.S. elections, certainly we were not looking for any hope in our situation out of either outcome. Both Hillary and Trump are actually not that different as far as greater evil in regards to Palestine and the world goes, he said. However, from my humble perspective, I believe that Trump as a U.S. president is much better than Hillary because somehow Trump reflects the true colors of the American society, a white supremacist racist society that has been living in denial and ignorance for a long time. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio.
A nation, our world of people, who do not use their intelligence are no better than animals who do not have intelligence. Such people are beasts of burden and stakes on the table by choice and consent. Do you fit that category, folks? I certainly hope not, because I believe we can get ourselves out of this situation if we will just open our eyes, our ears, and wake up. Stop believing what you're told and what you read and begin to find the truth for yourself.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. A decade of Republican Party policy changes are signed off in one week as the searchlights on Trump card Don's high tower swivel away from Russia and turn to point at China. And Hillary Clinton seems to have managed to escape criticism pretty much as the ruthless Lady Macbeth of the piece, her crooked superdelegates, stole the Democratic nomination from Bernie Sanders, helping Donald Trump to win. Also, the Zionist lobby are preparing to celebrate, poised to tick off point four, nearly two-thirds of the way along their unholy six-point plan for white Europeans to take over the Middle East. The moving of the Israeli capital I'm talking about from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem is step four of these six towards possibly a religious war between Israel and Iran, and Trump wants to do it. We also take another look at evidence for this long-term crusader land grab. Nearly 1,000 years after the medieval First Crusade, and every bit as barbaric, Israeli President Benjamin Netanyahu's 1980s book, Terrorism, How the West Can Win, and the infamous Oded Yinon plan to balkanise the Middle East. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM, 93.2 at noon every Tuesday this week. We heard a clip from it in the first hour. It's Chris Jones. He's disabled, but they're not paying him any benefits. He lives over in Nelson in Wales. Also, the level of revolution, John Rees, who wrote the book, cancelled an interview at the last minute, so we discuss his levelers book for him. That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. You can listen again at bcfmradio.com/dialect or download it from dialectradio.co.uk. First, Vary Threlfall's still with us, and I'm also joined by Jackson Moulding from Ecomotive. Hi, Jackson. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony.
Can you just tell us a little bit about Ecomotive? What do you do there?
Well, Ecomotive grew out of the Ashley Vale project in St. Werburgh's, and so we've...
Ashley Vale is quite an amazing place, isn't it? You go under that tunnel in St. Werburgh's. How did that all happen?
Yeah, through past the climate centre, through the graffiti tunnel, and
some
then
fantastic
a haven of a
yeah, some fantastic self-designed buildings. How did it? What's the story behind that?
Well, the project evolved because the site came available, and it's a 2-acre site, so it's quite a big site, and the local people living in the neighbouring houses were trying to find a way to give people a chance of having a home that they could afford, and self-build had already been undertaken by a couple of guys nearby, and they were very strong advocates, and they're saying this really needs to be a way. We should be creating homes where we get people involved and get people creating the spaces they want to live in, and actually it's a lot more affordable as well. So you get a whole myriad of wonderful benefits from that sort of project.
Well, I saw people pricking their ears up when you say it's more affordable. So it's, could it actually be cheaper to build your own home?
It certainly can be, because you can choose the budget. So you take, there's an element of sweat equity, and that's where you put your own hard graft into building. So if you can put more of your own time in, you get some savings there. You also get to save on the potential profit margin that a developer would take away. So there's a couple of areas there, but you can also choose your budget. So if you're, you know, if you're fully loaded with lots of money, you can actually build your grand designs or anything you like. If you've got lower budget, then you can obviously be more scrupulous about the sort of materials and things you use. And if you've got no budget, then there are projects like community land trusts where you can be involved, and then you could end up renting the home afterwards. And the community self-builder agency has been supporting ex-military people into self-finished homes through that mechanism as well.
Yes, I think there's a place up in Bedminster which Knightstone built, which was with ex-servicemen. But Jackson, did you actually build your own place there as well?
Or I did. I was lucky enough to be there at the right time and managed to get enough money from the bank to build a home.
How much did you actually put in money to get people to build it for you? Or were you actually physically putting kind of one brick on top of another yourself?
Yeah, we didn't use many bricks. We built it out of timber. But, yeah, did virtually all of it ourselves, me and my partner. And it was, it was a wonderful experience. And actually putting up the timber frame, there's almost nothing better than that. When that goes up and you look up and you think, wow, look, you know, we made a little model originally that was...
So is it still there? How's it getting on, the house?
It's still there. It hasn't creaked over. We're actually right beside the railway line, so as that goes past, you can sort of feel the rumble. But actually, in our place, it holds together really tightly. And actually, timber frame. I've just come back from a research trip in Japan, and where they've got obviously loads of earthquakes all the time, and there is a move towards timber housing, where they used to have actually in the past lots of timber buildings, but then they moved towards concrete. But then all the concrete and the sort of solid built homes sort of crumble with earthquakes. So actually timber houses are, you know, a way, strong houses of the past and strong houses for the future.
Now, in a way, this is a potential way out of this housing crisis, isn't it? Particularly, Vari, when you've got people who maybe have skills in building but don't have work. And I know that in Eastville there are a few projects actually on the go. So can you just tell us about those?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's really interesting. So you can hear the passion in Jackson's voice as he talks about the self-build project. I mean, it's a real example, I think, of the resistance against a very traditional market where you either rent from somebody else, in which case you're indebted to them and their whims, or you are tied to a mortgage and you've got various other issues in terms of buying a property that perhaps doesn't suit your needs for whatever reason. Self-build, I think, is really, really interesting. There's two projects in my ward at the moment. One is through the Bristol Community Land Trust. It's 12 properties, and as Jackson alluded, some of it is self-build, some of it is actually the sort of finishing, and there's a real mix there from studios right through to sort of three-bed houses.
So now, I think this is the one on, is it just on the edge of Eastville Park? As you're going up Fish Ponds Road on the left on Eastville Park, just you can see this kind of construction site. How it looks as if it could even be, last time I went past it, it looked like it could be nearly ready soon.
No, it's completed. There's seven units which are there's six three-bed homes which are shared equity, and there's one-bed home which is shared equity, and the other five are rented, affordable rents. So it's fantastic project. And the seven units which are shared equity are sold at 50% market value. So having a home right on the park, it's been fantastic.
Just explain this shared equity thing.
Okay, so shared equity is where you have the opportunity to buy into the home. So if you can raise some finance, you can get a mortgage, but you can't raise potentially the amount that you would need to buy the house at full market value. So if the house has a value of, say, £240,000 on the market, And you go into a shared equity approach with a community land trust or even a housing association, then whatever equity you buy would be the percentage you own. But effectively, it's still your home. You live in it. It's your space. And so if it's a 50% shared equity, you would pay £120,000 for a £240,000 home.
I suppose the big question is, are people being able to be housed there off of the housing list? Because we've got this massive, I think last time I looked, it was around about 15,000 people desperate for somewhere to live in the city.
Yeah, so I mean, from that one specifically, I mean, obviously that's people moving into those properties. I mean, the added advantage of that development is, of course, the developments for the community. So they have added a lot back into Eastville Park. In terms of people moving off the housing waiting list. Interestingly, and this isn't directly self-build, but links to this idea of the sort of social and environmental considerations when you're thinking about self-build, is what's been happening on the Dunmail site in Southmead. So that's 150 properties that are going to be built on this site, of which 30% are going to be affordable. And there's also going to be social housing in that mix. So they've partnered with United Communities. Now, the organisation behind that, the architecture firm, is HAB Housing, and they're a social enterprise. They've managed to get investment through the Bristol and Bath Regional Capital Fund, and it's very much a really interesting and different way at looking at development, one that is very much got that social mindedness, the environmental considerations. So you're talking about passive house as well, so they're all built to a really high environmental standard.
Okay, what is a passive house? I don't know if I like the sound of a passive house. It sort of just sort of sits there and doesn't really do anything. I suppose that's actually, maybe that's what you want, but what do you mean by a passive house?
So what it essentially is talking about is actually that it's got a sort of high environmental standards, so it will have decent sort of insulation standards. I mean, as a self-builder, you probably could describe
Jackson,
this better.
What
Jackson,
what is this? What's a passive house?
Yeah. A passive house is where you've got very, very low energy costs to run the home. I think it's
Now sounds good. Yeah,
it uses, what's the definite? It's like 15 kilowatt of energy per square meter throughout the year. So it's effectively, you have a very low running cost in terms of heating and hot water is pretty much the same throughout, because you still use the same amount of hot water, but certainly the heat. So it's reducing the amount of heat loss from the fabric of the building, and it tries to capture some of the energy as well.
So you're looking at the sort of internal as well as external modifications in terms of improving the insulation of the property. But Dunmail is a really, really, I think, exciting example of that on a larger site. And then on a smaller site, we've got another example within my ward, which is Bright Green Futures, and they're building 14 units. And what they're doing is really quite interesting in terms of their model, which is crowdfunding for properties. So they have maybe an identified site. So this one, for instance, is in Lower Grove Road. And then they have individuals sign up for that piece of land. They co-buy that piece of land, and then they co-build as well. So they're sharing the costs and materials, and they're sharing the costs of the build. So if people have the capacity and the ability to build, they do so. And they're also building in things like carpooling, community centres and cafes, all within the same structure. So it's really fascinating that model, that actually you could get people who maybe perhaps are complete strangers actually buying in together in order to be able to self-build and build their own home. And this is open to anybody, including those perhaps in the housing register.
Well, I suppose it sort of breaks the market of the developers, because these big house building firms have got almost a virtual monopoly, Jackson, haven't they?
Well, there's certainly a huge growing appetite out in there in terms of people wanting to have some sort of involvement in their future.
We don't
home.
Do this in Britain, do we? I mean, in other countries, I mean, my folks are in New Zealand. Mm. Everybody over there, they just build a house, and that's what you do. Well, not everybody, but most people, they will be involved in some way in actually designing that place as well. They say, oh, well, I think, you know, I want the rooms here and there, and you can have something off the peg, just like everyone does here. But and also, the other thing that bothers me about in Britain, the new houses that are being built here, is they seem to be getting smaller and smaller. It's like the ceilings are coming down and down. You know, they've got mirrors in the rooms to make them look bigger.
Well, we've got this interesting thing, isn't it? Where we create houses for profit, then the creation of the housing in itself is almost secondary to the creation of the finance. So if we can get back to the point where we're creating houses to create homes rather than for creating profit. And I think as soon as we put the people in a position where they're influencing what they're going to get, it changes the story. And so there's lots of people that live in very small spaces that are really fantastic, you know, living on canal boats, living in converted vehicles. There's the whole tiny house movement that's growing. There's a strong movement in Bristol that's growing. There's a tiny house movement here. It's sort of come over from America. And there's a lot of people that enjoy and would willingly live in a small space if they had some control over it.
You've got a tiny house movement in Kowloon. I've seen pictures of it in the Daily Mail, where you've got basically you've got a little box to live in that's hardly just about enough room for you and a fridge.
Well, yeah, so there's a balance here, isn't there? So there's a balance. If there's a top-down approach to creating tiny houses, particularly like by a developer that's creating profit and they can maximise out a site, get very high density, then that's the kind of the wrong route to creating small spaces. If you've got a sort of a growth from the ground about people going, actually, these are the sort of spaces we're willing to live in. We've got like a community space where we've got like a wider space we can sort of go out and be part of. You've got external space, growing space, social space. Then actually living in a small space, you know, like people love living. You know, there's a very romantic side to living on a canal boat where you've got, you know, you can get out of your boat, you can walk along the canal, you can have that interaction with other people.
Only if it's frozen over.
Well, yeah. Well, not actually on the canal. We're walking along beside the canal.
Yeah, but I mean, I think the main problem here is that these are only quite small projects, Vari, aren't they, at the moment? I mean, you know, we've got a big, if it is 15,000 still, it may be more. I'm sure it's not less. You know, how are we going to actually make a dent like this?
I think there's a huge possibility, but it needs to be upscaled. And I think what Jackson says is completely right about this idea that as long as you're focused on the bottom line, you're not going to get anywhere towards tackling the housing crisis, but also providing decent affordable accommodation for individuals. I mean, viability studies, if you talk to any councillor, we will bang our heads against the wall if you mention the word viability studies, because that's what a lot of these massive developers are doing in terms of trying to get out of their affordable housing requirements. And it's incredibly frustrating, whereas Bright Green Futures, when their planning application came through, they had their own names. They had names next to each property. This is Steffi's house. This is, you know, X's house. And I think that's quite interesting. And I think it's really very much about disrupting that market and actually changing the way people think about housing in a positive way. And I think that in itself will hopefully enable us to move forward with a lot of the other projects we're planning.
Well, and I think there certainly is a room here for some leadership as well from the local authority. It's fantastic that you're here now speaking about this as a local councillor. We've seen, you know, about 4 or 5 years ago, we went on a visit to Almere in Holland, where they've got a scheme of a fantastic scheme of 3,000 self builds on one site. You know, so this is, and Amsterdam has got a flurry of self build and people led housing projects. And those visits, the leader of Teignbridge Council attended, the leader of Cherwell Council attended. Both those local authorities now in the UK are leading the movement around community-led housing and self-build. So now in Cherwell in Oxfordshire, they've got a site of 2,000 custom-built homes. In Teignbridge, they've now got a housing policy that includes that you have to incorporate a number of self-build schemes into any larger development project.
This is really only okay, Jackson, isn't it, if you've got £100,000 at least in your back pocket?
No, not necessarily, because if you recall about 10 minutes ago, I mentioned that the community land trust method is around how we create housing that enables everyone to participate.
Well, that's why I said 100,000. I mean, so the community land trust will have the other half of the shared equity.
No, that's the shared equity element. So there's no reason why, through a community land trust model, that the community land trust can't actually create the finances to build out, and then those homes are then rented out into long term. Now, creating homes is obviously a complicated process, and there are costs there, and there's borrowing, and there's a reduction in the sort of funding that comes available. Now, the Bristol Community Land Trust that we helped set up about 5 years ago, halfway through the process in Eastfield Park in the Fishponds project, halfway through, the fund for us to receive the funding to enable those houses to be subsidised, Suddenly we were told by the Homes and Communities Agency that we needed to become a housing association. And it's like, well, yeah, the Bristol Community Land Trust wasn't set up to become a housing association. We already have wonderful and amazing housing associations in Bristol, but suddenly there's this bureaucratic process that the community-led housing movement has to kind of almost conform to meet the kind of requirements to work in this arena. So there are challenges.
There's a whole load of bureaucracy that comes with that, I guess.
There is, and there's trying to find a way through that. And we have, the Fishponds project is virtually completed. The hoarding's still to come down, and that's going to be exciting. The group is that group particularly finished the homes to a self-finished process, so they all were able to acquire extra equity in their homes.
Okay, so that's a kind of halfway house. Oh, gosh, I shouldn't say that, should I? Between self-building and buying a purpose-built house, it's self-finished. What does a house look like when you arrive to self-finish it?
Well, we got the group involved really early on. So actually they were involved before the structure of the buildings went up. But effectively what the group got was they got the shells of the building. They were watertight and secure. And then insides were completely open. So they were able to fit their own kitchens, fit their own flooring, decorate, fit their own tiling. We did get the bathrooms and all the toiletry and the sinks and stuff installed. But effectively, those finishes were undertaken by the people coming in. And then there's all the externals. So all the landscaping, the design of the space outside was all put back into their hands. So the Community Land Trust owns that space, but the group feel, and they feel it is effectively their space. And as a group, they make the decisions and they work out how much budget they want to put to different aspects to it. You know, do they want to raise beds? Do they want to, fancy bike parking? Do they want to create sheds? These things they can use the budget to work on that. So the self-finished model, it's not just about making a financial benefit, but it's actually about how you bring a group together and create a community through that sense of participation.
I suppose the big question is going to be, can the council help with all this sort of thing, and to what extent they can, Fari?
Absolutely. I mean, there's certain things that we can do.
Obviously, you can help by giving people planning permission. That helps.
Sites is the best.
I think it's sites identification. So Dunmail, I mean, this is, I should have said earlier, Dunmail actually is a council site, which is why it's been quite easy to kind of, I say easy, it's been a long journey, but easier than, say, if it was a private site. But certainly site identification is one way the council can help. But equally, and I'm sure Paul Smith will be talking more about this, but around us creating our own housing delivery company. So actually how we can support self-build within that, and how we can support self-build in terms of our strategic priorities as well, would be quite an interesting thing to explore.
Yeah, there's loads of people who are really interested in this out there that would maybe like to, especially go and have a look at these existing schemes, and then maybe to sign up to do something in the future. I mean, I can remember years ago talking to a guy called David John from Spring Hill in Stroud, who created their own kind of company to build a co-housing project there. And they ended up finding that once they'd finished building it, that everybody had their own homes there, but they were actually, almost on the first day, worth almost twice as much as they paid for them. So this is actually, you could almost spend your life doing this and become a millionaire very quickly by just building great houses and then building another one and then selling the one you've just built. But anyway,
that's a really interesting point, and actually it's used quite often, particularly for the Ashley Vale project. It's like, wow, you guys have gone in there and you've made all these lovely big houses, and now you're all like sitting on this massive wealth. The question is why is that seen as a, like, firstly, that's obviously seen as a negative, but the key thing is these houses are only worth more because there aren't more projects happening around the place. If actually these sort of projects were happening everywhere, then it wouldn't seem so individualist or so separate to everything else. So actually what we need to do is enable and seed projects across the city, across the southwest, which are community led. They're fantastic places to live, and it won't be seen such as a different sort of place.
What about signing up to this? Because I know the council has got a list of some sort of people who, anyone that's interested in doing self-build. Do we know about that?
Yeah, there's two things here. One is that there's new legislation that's came out last April, which put into place the requirement for every local authority in England to have a register of people who are interested in creating their own homes. Now, some local authorities have still got to get up to speed with that. Bristol holds its own register in-house. There is a local self-build register, which is a national platform that South Gloss and Baines use. And if anyone is interested in building their own place, whether it's through a co-housing or community land trust or other form of community-led housing project, then it's really worth putting your name, contacting the local authority, putting your name on that list, because there is now a requirement for the local authority to provide planning permission for service plots for the number of that's equivalent to the number of people that are registered on that list. And so there's a really fantastic opportunity to provide that lever to really encourage the local authority to move in this area. The second thing is, and this is a fantastic move that's come out of central government, and it's taken a long time to bring this forward. We set up the National Customer Self-Build Association back in 2008, and that's been lobbying central government for a long time around this. And there's a community-led housing alliance that's been working more recently around this. But just before Christmas, the government announced £60 million to go out to local authorities across the country to support them to empower more community-led housing projects. Now, that £60 million has been identified to particular local authorities that have already been proactive. Unfortunately, Bristol didn't get any of the first tranche, which is really sad. But it'd be really great if we can get to a position next year when they do the next tranche to get the next £60 million, because it's going to be £60 million a year for the next 5 years. So this is for outreach, for support, for enabling groups and communities to come together and work out what they need to
now,
do.
Now, Bristol's got its own list for anyone that's interested in building their own place. But there is a kind of national scheme as well, isn't there?
Well, there's the local self-build register, which is actually enabling, which people can register on, and that their information will be collected and then provided to local authorities that use that platform. But lots of local authorities are using their own platform as well.
And so what do you get if you sign up to that list?
You don't get anything directly. What you're doing is effectively, it's a formal way of having a petition. What you're doing is you're putting your name down to say, I am interested in sometime in the future that I would like to be able to build my own place. Even if you're not physically building it, you'd like to influence your future home. Mm. And by putting your name on that list, the local authority can see what the demand is, and they have a legislative requirement to make planning permission plots available. Now, it might be that you put your name on the list and you don't get one of those plots, but they have a process. They've just finished the first base period that ran from the 1st of April to the end of October last year, 2016, and they've now got 3 years to provide planning permissions for that number. Now, they're in the second base period, so anyone that's interested should find their local authority.
So, I mean, is there any sort of networking happening around those people? I mean, are they being invited along to things, say, look, you know, this is a new self-build project that may happen in your area, that kind of thing, or what?
Well, you've got to think, well, who's covering that? You know, local authorities are just trying to get by in the sort of the normal day-to-day.
No, the local authorities won't, no.
Local authorities haven't actually been given any budget to maintain or run this register, so it's actually an additional workload on top of their normal day-to-day.
Which is being cut, of course.
Yeah, so it, you know, it's an additional pressure, and it's understandable. But there's no reason why people can't start proactively maybe trying to set up their own schemes. And, you know, obviously BCFM gets heard all across the country. And so if you're
the
listening... across the world, yeah, of course. So, you know, if you are... It's worth contacting your local authority and finding out if your local authority has been one of the selected 148 local authorities that have got a chunk of the 60 million, and say, you know, what is happening, and most of these local authorities will start outreaching.
And Jackson, where can people go and actually look at places that have already been built? Because I think that's what really inspires you, when you can see a place and think, good God, this is gorgeous.
Well, there's some great projects in Bristol. There's great projects out Bristol. Mm-hmm. We've got the Ashley Vale project is obviously one that anyone can come and walk around, and it's down by the City Farm. It's an award-winning City Farm, so you can go down and you have some nice bite to eat at lunchtime
that's
on the weekend.
St. Werburgh.
St. Werburgh's in the heart of Bristol, near IKEA. That's one. There's Stroudcoe Housing, which is obviously in Stroud.
That's Spring Hill, the one I mentioned.
Spring Hill, yep. There's the Leeds Lilac housing project, which I'm not sure actually if they're inviting people to look around yet, because I think they had a bit of
sort of somewhere you can go for the day, maybe with the kids or whatever, around here, within easy distance, or in Bristol itself?
Well, if you're walking around Eastfield Park, then you can always walk to the top of Eastfield Park and you can see those buildings that are there from the outside.
You can actually do almost a bit of a journey going from St. Werburgh's up to Eastfield Park and then down towards Grove Road, which is on the other side of Eastfield Park, and see three build projects in one. And what I would recommend as well is that people check out the website. So check out Bristol Community Land Trust website, which details a lot of the process and the history and how they went through that. And also look at Bright Green Futures, because what they do is quite interesting, is that they put up plots of land that they've identified, and you can sign up to or express interest in those sites, and then they go from there, from that point on, in terms of looking at finance. So it's a very interesting model that Bright Green Futures are applying, and I'm sure that could be replicable.
Yeah, and that the Bright Green Futures model has been using the Ashley Vale which is the setup on the same scheme. But we're setting up through Ecomotive our Snug Home program. So we mentioned earlier like the bureaucracy around trying to get projects happening, and we also recognise the tiny house movement, and what we want to do is try and combine the two. How do we reduce the bureaucracy but get a bit of a fast track approach? So we are now in the process, and we would welcome people to come and get involved. We are going to be setting up a people's factory, so we want to create a self-build experience but within a controlled environment, and we are going to be building these modular housing units using timber, low impact building materials. We are currently looking for a venue within Bristol to have a factory space, but there's a sort of slight catch-22 between having a supply out to where the houses can be built and go out to sites without taking on a big space, because there's obviously quite high rental of a big warehouse.
Now I can see I'm going to have a lot of work to do on tonight's show page with links to all these various things, particularly to things like Ecomotive. I think I should actually put a map up, shouldn't I, really, have a little your walk, Vari, so people can see whereabouts to go in the city to see this. And it sounds like there's actually quite a lot going on, and also I'll put a link to the council's register for anyone that's interested, and to your register, the national one as well, Jackson, for anyone that's not actually living in Bristol. So look, I'd just like to thank you both very much for talking about that. Sounds quite exciting. And anyone out there that's interested in building your own home, well, I mean, actually, or even living in a self-designed home, you don't have to take one of these horrible little shoeboxes where you're living in a tiny little room from Persimmon Homes, folks, because we're doing it different in Bristol now. Yeah. Thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Yeah,
Thank you.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Martin, we've had a week, actually, of these various different things that Donald Trump has been bringing. I think probably the most hypocritical, most horrendous one is the stopping of the... the resumption of the Dakota Pipeline, which all these Native Americans have been protesting about.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things he's done. Obviously, he's, the pressure on US presidents, especially when there's a kind of change of regime, as there has been, is to do everything in the first 100 days, like Franklin Delano Roosevelt did in 1933. And Trump obviously intends to sort of try and achieve as much as he possibly can in the first 100 days.
I mean, I said at the top of the hour, didn't I, that this is almost 10 years of Republican policies that they've been building up and building up. And he's basically got a big stack of executive orders. He's signing one, another.
You know, it's just like a whole load of them.
Yeah.
Let's just look at what's happened in the first week. Cutting funding for the Department of Justice Violence Against Women program. He's cutting funding. In fact, he's cutting funding for thousands of things. Certainly scores. A National Endowment for the Arts is being cut. A National Endowment for Humanities. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting is also being cut. The Minority Business Development Agency is being cut. Economic Development Administration. The Manufacturing Extension Partnership, I have no idea what that is actually. The Office of the Community Orientated Policing Services, the Legal Services Corporation, well, that helps people who are poor pay for legal help. Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice is being cut. Environmental National Resources Division. So, actually, also a UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is cutting the money for that.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, what the idea is that this is all the waste and bureaucracy, and he's going to get rid of it all, and it's about time to.
On a more sinister note, I mean, he's also, I see, cutting. He's ordered the National Park Service to stop using social media, and that is, I mean, this is just saying it basically trying to control. It's just a kind of control freakery going on here.
Yeah, well, the National Park Service had said something out of line in relation to the inauguration, I believe, so he's decided to give them a hit just to teach them a lesson.
How would you characterise all this? I mean, it's a massive load of executive orders, and we've got Theresa May with him apparently right now.
Well, I mean, he's let's be clear. I mean, he campaigned on a pretty reactionary programme. And he won the election in the United States, even though he didn't win the majority of the votes. He's trying now to argue.
This is a bit sneaky of a thing to say, yeah, because he's having to deal with an electoral college system, and that might mean that he would campaign in one place
That's
more
what he said.
To win the. I mean, it's not what he said. It's what all presidents do.
No, well, indeed, but you can understand that in the United.
I mean, it's like in this country, Martin. Just a minute. It's really picking splitting hairs to say, oh, he didn't win the majority of the votes. Because every president that tries to get elected knows they've got an electoral college system to get around. So they have to, try and get the votes in particular states. Because the system isn't exactly, it's not a proper proportional representation system, is it?
It's not even a proper first-past-the-post system, Tony, is it? What it is the American electoral system. And, of course, in Cuba they have an electoral system and they have elections. But you have to be vetted by the Communist Party before you can stand in those elections. Are those elections free and fair? Well, the audience can make up its own mind. In the United States of America, under a constitution written in the 1770s by wealthy white men who didn't want to give women or blacks, who were slaves, the vote. It was rigged quite deliberately to make sure that's what the Electoral College is there for. It's to make sure that we don't have a purely democratic system.
Fresh from 200 years of genocide, by the way.
Yes, indeed. Now, the fact is that Donald Trump has won under the existing system, as George W. Bush did in 2000. He didn't win a majority of the votes either. Now, people say, yeah, but that's the American system, that's the American way. But you've got to understand that in the rest of the world, in the barrios in Latin America, in the slums in Southeast Asia, in South Africa, they look at that and say, yeah, that's the American system, but that ain't democracy. And there's a real question for Trump of legitimacy. What is your actual mandate for all of this? We know what your views are. We know what you want to do, although it's not clear, actually, whether you do want to go to war with China or not, or whether you really do want to back the Israelis to build more settlements, although you're saying that's what you want. Now, we know what you want. You say you've won the election, that's true, but what legitimacy have you got? Putin has got legitimacy. He got 80% of the vote in the September. His party, United Russia, took not 80%, it's about 65% of the vote in the September election in Russia, which was hardly reported in the Western media.
I think it was just under 60%.
Yeah, indeed.
Assad did do really well.
Assad got much better. Yeah. So in other words, Trump's problem is that both Putin and Assad have got better electoral mandates than he's got. I think, I won, and that's all that counts. Well, it's all that counts if that's all you're concerned about. But in terms of your real legitimacy,
Because if you're going to go to war with countries like Syria and Russia, the question is going to arise, have they got more legitimacy than you? And if they have, they're going to have a big advantage when that battle starts.
What about Theresa?
And it's already started.
Theresa May has got a majority, I believe it's now 11, where 30 of her MPs are facing prosecution for fraud in the 2015's general election.
Now, what percentage of the vote did the Conservative Party get at the general election? 37, was it? If that. But she's got total power. All ministers are appointed by the Prime Minister on the back of 37%. And you know what? People in Scotland and people in Northern Ireland, they don't accept the legitimacy of that either. And the people in Northern Ireland so far don't accept the legitimacy of it that they fought a civil war in which 3,000 plus people died. And the British Army, as we know from recent revelations, were involved in hundreds of murders because there was no legitimacy to the system. Now, the problem for Trump is, if you push a hard-line agenda, which you are pushing, when you've actually not got a mandate for it, you could provoke a civil war in a country where, as we all know, everybody's got automatic weapons. And if people don't think that in 4 years' time, after an economic collapse, there couldn't be a civil war in America, they need to have a word with themselves, because it's quite possible. Much less likely in Russia. Much less likely.
Okay,
they've got real consensus.
Let's have a look at 12. This is PBS NewsHour's 12 executive actions Trump has signed just in the first week. The border wall. He says it's the policy of the US to immediately construct a wall for the southern border. Had a bit of a row with the Mexicans the last couple of days over this, and Mexicans have cancelled a visit because he says he's going to try and get the Mexicans to pay. Well, of course, actually, what he said about that is that he's going to put a 20% tax on everything from Mexico coming into the US and use that to pay for the wall.
Well, what the Mexican foreign minister said, well, what that means is that effectively the US consumers will find that their stuff they buy from Mexico is 20% more expensive. They're going to pay for the wall. And don't forget that we're also put 20% tariffs on your imports to us. So people are going to lose. It's when you threaten trade retaliation, you could find that other people are going to, you know, it's going to be reciprocal, isn't it? Other people are going to put up barriers to your stuff. Now, that's a lose-lose scenario for everybody. But there's no reason why the Mexicans are going to say, you're going to export to us, but you're going to put a 20% tariff on our exports, but we're going to not put tariffs
there's
on your exports.
Martin, there's also a massive increase in deportations, apparently. Trump has prioritised 7 groups of people. Anyone convicted of a crime, charged with a crime, who's committed a chargeable offence, misrepresented themselves to the government, has abused a welfare programme, who is under deportation order, may, in the judgment of an immigration officer, otherwise pose a risk to public safety or national security. And apparently he's going to hire 10,000 more. He is in the process of hiring 10,000 new immigration and customs enforcement agents.
I'll tell you what he won't be doing is in hiring more tax collection people, will he? Because he's going to cut taxes. And therefore, so he's going to waste taxpayers' money on deporting people who are possibly working and paying taxes, but he's going to ease up and cut funding on things like collecting taxes. Because, hey, we all know he's not put his tax return in the public domain, even though he said he would. And do you know why? Because he hasn't paid any taxes for years. That's why.
He's also reviewing, he says, manufacturing regulations, and that is effectively deregulation of manufacturing processes.
Yep.
So the manufacturers can pretty much do what they want, use all sorts of, cut safety, I suppose that's largely about, isn't it? He's also saying that American steel must be put in all pipelines, and also speeding up environmental reviews for all priority infrastructure. So that's to say that, you know, if there's going to be infrastructure going in, they're going to do a very, very fast track looking at the environment thing, and probably won't. But the most important I mentioned earlier was this speeding up the approval of the Dakota Access and Keystone oil pipelines, which has really annoyed Native Americans.
Well, yeah, I mean, that, of course, as you mentioned earlier, Alex Jones, one of the big supporters of Trump, has been opposing this pipeline, and now his great hero is going to support it. And various other people have been involved in various campaigns, which Trump has, they look to Trump to help them. And in actual fact, he's going to do exactly what his corporate backers tell him to do.
Okay, also a federal hiring freeze. The president has told all agencies they're not allowed to fill any vacant positions nor open any new ones.
Yeah, well, a lot of this stuff is very much rocking the boat. He could start a trade war with China. Don't forget, if you say all steel in pipelines in America has to come from America, then the Chinese are going to turn round and say, right, all steel in China has to come from China. And we, when we're doing a deal with them, as Theresa May is doing this afternoon, we might say, no, we're not having any American steel being used in Britain. It's got to be British steel, because everybody's going to have the same policy as you, Donald. Britain first, China first.
I mean, isn't Theresa May there really just as a vassal? Isn't Britain a vassal of the American Empire?
Well, she's in a weak position at the moment because she needs a deal with the US because of the swift Brexit she's going for. And, of course, in that position, the deal you are going to get from Trump is rubbish. I think that if we're going to have Brexit, we need to go back to WTO rules.
We do forget this.
There's no point doing deals
with
the Americans.
Theresa May's husband Philip is a manager of a massive US LA-based investment firm.
Well, indeed. So, in other words, the question for Theresa May, who's demanding sovereignty back from Brussels, are we going to get our sovereignty back from Brussels and hand it straight away to Donald Trump? I'm not prepared to sign. I would hope the Parliament will not sign any deal with the US until we know what's in it. Trump's position, which, as we know, is so nationalistic, it's unlikely that we're ever going to find common ground with him on such a deal. So what are we talking about having a deal with him for? It's ridiculous.
He's pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership too, as well, which was actually quite a nasty-looking trade deal, which meant that you'd be able to have courts suing governments if they enacted laws.
Yeah, but what do you think Trump's going to demand of the British if they want a trade deal? He's going to want US corporations to be able to sue the British government if they're not happy with what they do. Fascinatingly enough, Australia and New Zealand have suggested that the Trans-Pacific Partnership could be resurrected with China in the place of America. And of course, the whole point of the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal was to shut the Chinese out of the Southeast Asian market. So in other words, he might have shot himself in the foot there, because everybody in Southeast Asia may say, oh, that's all dead then, so we'll all have to do a deal with China. Meanwhile, you can put up tariffs against our exports, but we're going to put up tariffs against your exports. Tariffs against American exports to Australia, New Zealand, China, everywhere else. We're going to go for a trade war. Now, what Trump's got to realise is that with the weak US economy, as it has been hollowed out by years of deindustrialisation, it could well be that a full-on trade war with the Chinese, who are actually cutting edge on many things, you're going to lose that trade war. It's not going to be a plus, it's going to be a loss for you.
I mean,
but hey, let's go down that road and find out what happens.
We had the Saker on last week, this former UN military analyst. One of the things he says is that actually economic warfare is a large part of modern warfare.
Absolutely.
And it's, I think he said it was 80% information warfare, 15% economic warfare, and only 5% shooting wars.
Indeed. And therefore, if I was Trump, which I'm not, even if I wanted to carry through a nationalistic policy, I would keep it quiet, because therefore you might be able to persuade people to go along with what you're doing without frightening them. But if you're going to be bombastic about it, I mean, the Mexican response to 20% tariffs on their exports is going to be quite simple. It'll be a 25% tariff on US exports to Mexico. And let's see who loses the most jobs here.
OK, well, let's have a look at the foreign policy, and picked up a great little piece from, I thought it was good anyway, it was on Press TV, which of course is banned here in Britain by Ofcom. That's the Iranian state broadcaster. And we had on there just yesterday a chap called Keith Preston. He's an analyst from a US website and think tank called attackthesystem.com. Now, I'm sure that comes in those fake news lists that the CIA put out and the BBC put out. But let's have a listen to what he's got to say, because I think he made quite a lot of sense.
It's interesting to observe what Trump has done over the past few days since he's assumed office, and that he is going to follow through with many things he said he was going to do on the campaign trail. Primarily what he's aiming to do right now is to establish his own credibility, to show that he was serious about the things that he said he wanted to do, including enacting a more restrictive immigration policy in terms of building the wall along the Mexican border, reducing the visas that are issued to travelers or migrants from particular countries. And I think that it's interesting to look into how this fits into Trump's overall foreign policy outlook. On one hand, Trump gave a speech back on December 1st in Cincinnati, Ohio, where he said that the United States was going to pull back from interventionism in the affairs of other countries and developed a more a non-interventionist foreign policy paradigm, and instead focus on fighting terrorism committed by the Daesh and groups like that. On the other hand, though, there was an interesting article by Pete Escobar in the South China Morning News yesterday outlining what seems to be the foreign policy paradigm that Trump is pursuing. And it seems to be a foreign policy paradigm that's been developed by the Center for Strategic and International Studies, which is associated with Henry Kissinger, a longstanding veteran American diplomat. And it looks like that what the American foreign policy under Trump is going to be is something that's going to involve moving the United States closer to Russia, and in the process trying to move Russia away from China and Iran. Because of the actions of the Bush, the last two American presidential administrations, the Obama administration and the Bush administration, as a result of the very aggressive militaristic foreign policy that the United States has pursued under those two administrations, Russia has certainly moved closer to China and to Iran as well. Certainly, Russia and China now have formed the BRICS trade bloc. Russia has moved closer to Iran over the war against the Daesh. So I think that the particular wing of the foreign policy establishment that Trump represents, or the American elite that Trump represents, is trying to move Russia away from this. I think they see it as a concerning issue from the point of view of American foreign policy interests that the BRIC alliance and the Shia crescent in the Middle East are moving closer together, and I think they want to create a greater wedge between Russia and China and between Russia and Iran. So I think that's the general foreign policy approach that we're going to see with Donald Trump's administration. On one hand, he's going to be more hawkish on China and Iran, more dovish on Russia, with the particular goal of disrupting that triangle that's developed.
Yeah, and it's a pretty delusionary policy, because the Russians would be foolish to take Trump at his word. One of the things Trump said in a throwaway remark this week, that he's definitely going to create safe zones for refugees in Syria, because he's banning Syrian refugees from the US, largely, and he's criticised Angela Merkel for opening the doors of Germany to them. And he's saying, the way of solving this is solve problem number one, well, we're going to create safe areas inside Syria. Now, the reason why they haven't created safe areas inside Syria is because the Pentagon, Dunford and various other people have made it absolutely clear, well, the only way we can do that is if we go to war with the Syrian Air Force and the Russian Air Force. We'll have to shoot all their planes down and knock out all of their anti-aircraft stuff before we can create a safe zone. And that's just not on unless we're going to have an all-out war with Syria and Russia. Now, it strikes me as very odd that he should have mentioned this stuff and that he doesn't really understand the implication. But the Russians will be drawing the relevant conclusions. They know that Trump, despite his noises in their direction, is a joker, just like most of the other people who run the United States of America.
Okay, what about this whole thing, though, of possibly wanting to confront China as a way of, I suppose, dealing with them before he deals with the Russians, maybe? And also, I suppose, the big fear of the US, and then this article is excellent that this chap mentioned. I've just brought it up here. It's in the South China Morning Post.
It's
Trump will try to smash the China-Russia-Iran triangle, and here's why he will fail, by Pepe Escobar. It's Iran and Russia that is the real problem for the US military, in that an alliance between these two, and of course the Russians have been using at certain points the Iranian air bases to attack. This alliance between Russia and Iran is the thing that they're going to. They looks as if this is what seems to be happening. Is that they're trying to take the focus off of Russia, so that will hopefully split those two countries. And this is a kind of divide and rule tactic, so they can pick off Iran.
Yeah, but I mean, the fact is that they're having this debate about which country are we going to attack first in public. And of course, the Russian general staff, the Chinese general staff, and the Iranian general staff, who are all on a war footing, they just think, well, okay, you can say that, but we're not going to accept it. He's also supporting the Israelis, who may invade Lebanon sometime soon with his support. They will come into direct conflict with the Syrian army and with the Russian Air Force
also,
if they do that.
Trump is saying apparently it's too early to decide whether to move the US embassy to Jerusalem from Tel Aviv, although this is one of his election promises.
Ah, well, he's suddenly started to stub his toe up against reality. which is that nobody says that apart from you. And if you do say that, then you've got no influence in various parts of the world. You know, he's got a list of things he wants to do, but of course they're all contradictory things. So if he does one of them, it actually messes up another of the things he wants to do.
Well, as I mentioned,
which suggests that he hasn't thought any of it through, doesn't it?
As I mentioned at the top of the hour, this is step four. Stephen Sizer, the vicar from London, has pointed this out, who's studied Zionism and written about it, on the Zionist plan to really just simply take over the Middle East. And so this is what Stephen Sizer had to say back in 2008 about this whole idea of moving the capital of Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem.
I want to highlight six ways in which Christian Zionists are applying their faith politically. One, defending Israel. Two, assisting Jewish emigration. Three, supporting the illegal settlements. Four, lobbying for an exclusive Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. And five, funding the rebuilding of the Jewish temple. Six, opposing the peace process. I'm going to show you these six strategies are exacerbating tensions in the Middle East, and they are hastening Armageddon. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Fourth, Jerusalem, lobbying for international recognition. At the core of the Christian Zionist support for Israel's claim to the occupied territories lies the conviction that Jerusalem must remain exclusively and undivided the Israeli capital. If you know your geography, you will know that there are no embassies in Jerusalem. The international community does not recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, notwithstanding Marks and Spencer's Atlas, which shows Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. So the Christian Zionist lobby is seeking to change world opinion and facilitate Jerusalem becoming the capital of Israel. How are they going to do that? Very easy. You need $100 million and one bill through the U.S. Congress to move the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. That's all it will take. In 1995, Senator Bob Dole, who led the crusade to achieve this, said Israel's capital is not on the table of the peace process. Moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem does nothing to prejudice the outcome of any future negotiation. That's pretty Orwellian in its logic. It's entirely opposite. It prejudices everything because it destroys an independent, viable, contiguous Palestinian state. If you take Jerusalem out of the ingredients, there is no Palestine. Senator Bob Dole went on to say, Jerusalem is today, as it has always been for 3,000 years, the heart and soul of the Jewish people. It is also and should remain forever the eternal undivided capital of the State of Israel. The time has come to enact legislation to get the job done. Three occasions, Congress has passed legislation to do that. Three times, successive U.S. presidents have refused to sign off on the legislation. But it's a question of when it will happen, not whether. Give you an insight. The International Christian Embassy sponsoring adverts in the New York Times called Christians to support a united Jerusalem. United meaning exclusively Israeli, not united in the way we would understand. We, the undersigned Christian spiritual leaders communicating weekly to more than 100 million Christian Americans, are proud to join together in supporting the continued sovereignty of the State of Israel over the holy city of Jerusalem. We believe Jerusalem, any portion of it, should not be negotiable in the peace process. Jerusalem must remain undivided as the eternal capital of the Jewish people. You hear this mantra all the time, but notice how they end their advert. Join us in our holy mission to ensure Jerusalem will remain the capital of Israel. Moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem is a holy mission.
And Donald Trump apparently is on it, Martin.
Except that he's had to back down because he's suddenly realised that he's escalating and he doesn't know what the end of it's going to be.
Also, there's this massive settlement programme just started. That will help things in East Jerusalem, won't it?
No, it won't. And, of course, if he keeps pushing this pro-Israeli line, he's going to come into conflict with the Syrians and the Russians. So he's not making peace with them either.
Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Coming up, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Cabinet Member for...
This
no, actually, no, it wasn't a Cabinet Member at all. It was Vari Threlf, also to Jackson Moulding. Our sister show Dialects on Tuesday. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down. Point.
101.1 KFCF in Fresno and 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz. Online at kpfa.org. It's 11 a.m. Stay tuned for Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. I am Malihera Sazan.
And I'm Khalil Bendib. This week we'll spend the hour looking at the legacy of Hashemi Rafsanjani, Iran's former president and a key player in the aftermath of the 1979 revolution. Shahram Aghamir will speak with Kaveh Ehsani, assistant professor of international studies at DePaul University in Chicago, and Mansour Farhang, professor emeritus of international relations at Bennington College in Vermont, who was Iran's first ambassador to the United Nations after the revolution.
On January 8th, Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani, the chairman of Iran's powerful Expediency Council and former president of Iran, died of a heart attack at the age of 82. Rafsanjani was a founding member of Iran's 1979 revolution, a close confidant of the current supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, and he also played a key role in elevating Khamenei to his current position as Khomeini's successor. Many considered him as Khomeini's right-hand man, and in the Western media, he was often characterized as a moderate. So who was Rafsanjani, and how consequential was his role in shaping the Islamic regime? Shahram Aghamir put these questions to Mansour Farhang, professor emeritus of international relations at Bennington College.
If we go back with respect to historical development of the revolution, this guy played a central role. No question about it, because Rafsanjani was a man who was first and foremost interested in consolidation of power, and both for himself and for the Islamic Republic. And he used ideology from the very beginning. He used ideology as a tool. He was not a believer, because many of the people who were involved, including Khomeini himself, in the revolution, but you know, for better or worse, they were genuine believers, and they really thought that they were following certain principles and all that. But Rafsanjani was not like that at all. For example, he was very much opposed to hostage-taking, because he was first and foremost a businessman, very much interested in having normal economic and trade relationship with the Western world. And he knew that the hostage taking is going to be very damaging to that objective with respect to national interest, class interest. And yet, because he knew that Khomeini was very much committed to the idea and the popular base was also committed to it, he pretended as if, you know, he was a supporter. In 1982, he was very much interested in ending the war after Iranians managed to expel the occupying Iraqi forces from Iran, particularly when Saudi Arabia and the Persian Gulf Arab states offered Iran close to $20 billion for war reparation if Iran accepted the ceasefire resolution of the United Nations Security Council. Rafsanjani was very much in favor of accepting it, but politically, it would have been suicidal for him to take that position. So he followed, you know, Khomeini, and the war went on for 6 more years. And now we know that even 6 more years, he played a central role in convincing Khomeini that the war is going to be a real threat to the stability of the regime. So there are many of these examples. And finally, there is no question, based on a variety of evidence, that after Khomeini's death, he played a central role in making Ayatollah Khomeini succeed Khomeini, just as he had played a central role in excluding and demoting Ayatollah Montazeri. Mm-hmm. He thought at the time that Ayatollah Khamenei will be in charge of kind of symbolic leader of the Islamic Republic, ideologically and so forth. And at this, he will leave the economic issues, the foreign policy issues, to Rafsanjani. What he didn't know was that the man in the position of power gradually didn't want any competition and step by step excluded him to the extent that he became pretty much irrelevant in terms of policy making in the Islamic Republic. And yet, because toward the end of his life, I would say, particularly after the election or semi-election of 2009, when he took really a critical position implicitly toward Khomeini and the Revolutionary Guards, he became somewhat popular among the young Iranians who didn't really pay attention to his background. After all, today 70% of the population in Iran is under 40. So he really gained some popularity among younger Iranians and, again, people who were more pragmatic in the approach to uniform policy within the regime. So he gained that kind of popularity. So when he died, you know, the regime is very clever. They just, now that he is dead, let's treat him as if he was an insider. So he will not die as an oppositional, as a critical personality within the regime. They played a very clever game, which might not have affected a good part of the society, but it definitely had a positive impact on their own constituency.
Professor Farhang, Mr. Rafsanjani began his political activism under the previous regime of the Shah. Just briefly, why don't you tell us about this period of his life, and what was it about him that stood out during that period? He was involved in different things, including providing arms to a group that was responsible for assassination of one of the former prime ministers in Iran under the Shah.
It's very interesting. If you read the book he wrote about Amir Kabir, which I read, you read the book and you clearly get the impression that he is more of a religious nationalist. Mm-hmm, he even praises Mossadegh. He was a pro-Mossadegh person. But the prime minister from 1951 to 1953, who was overthrown by the CIA-engineered coup.
Okay.
So he was even pro-Mossadegh, while Khomeini had nothing but contempt for Mossadegh. But once after the revolution, when he realized that how Khomeini resented even the name of Mossadegh, let alone thinking of a movement after his name, then he became quiet. So we see the same duality. He is really, I wrote an article on his tombstone, we should write Ayatollah Machiavelli. Exactly. And he was really an Ayatollah Machiavelli. I didn't, even before the revolution, because if you read his book, as I did, and you get a positive impression in the sense that this guy is kind of a religious nationalist along the line of Bazargan, Bani Saj, and those types of people. But then at the same time, now we learn that in the underground clerical movement, he was active and he even supported the assassination of a political figure, former prime minister. So that I didn't know at all. But if you read his writings, Rafsanjani himself came to the United States with non-clerical clothing. He has three sons. They didn't go to Hosea Romani. His daughters, one of them very critical of the regime. So it's obvious that he didn't even raise his children to become clerks. And at the same time, he was a product of that organization. He was a student of Khomeini. So he had a dimension of kind of a nationalist, conservative, free market-oriented politician. At the same time, he wanted power, and he wanted to be very close to a popular base that only could be organized on the basis of a religious discourse that Khomeini provided. So from the very beginning, he was both. And he lost the competitive game to Khomeini. He thought he was, as a Machiavellian Ayatollah, he thought he would be able to have Khomeini as the symbolic supreme leader, and he would be exercising real power behind the scenes. I would say from the very beginning of his political life, we see both the pragmatic, free market, capitalist-oriented individual. We also see someone who is, wants to be close to popular culture, to clerical authority, and thinking that pursuit of power and winning in competition with the liberals and the leftists, they need a radical Islamic ideology, and he adopted that.
The next month will be marking the 38th anniversary of Iranian Revolution of 1979. As it has been the case with major revolutions, once the Ancien regime was dislodged in Iran, the fault lines within the camp of the victors surfaced. The Islamist bloc essentially consolidated power in the first 2 years by resorting to violence and outmaneuvering the secular nationalists, the liberals, and the left. What role did Rafsanjani play in making sure that power was monopolized by the Islamist bloc?
Okay, this is really an excellent question. And in order to respond to that question, one has to begin by saying that the secular Iranians in the post-revolutionary period were badly fragmented. They spent much of the time discrediting each other, questioning each other's loyalty. The leftists made an insult out of the word liberal, and the clerics had never used the word liberal. So for reasons that at the time, because the leftists were very ideological, they thought about the society in completely reductionist class terms, and ideologically and theoretically, they saw the liberal, the social democratic type, the nationalist type as the real competitor for their purpose of taking over the state. The idea that the clerics will have the power to take over the state and completely destroy both the liberal and the left, it didn't fit the theory by which they were motivated and guided in their action. The liberals the same way. The liberals and nationalists with respect to their attitudes toward the left and the cleric. So when the question came that yes, Rafsanjani played a very significant and clever role in using the fragmentation of the secular Iranians in the interest of clerical ascendancy. In the beginning, they used the Tudeh Party against Bazargan, the Communist Party of Iran, a segment of also the leftists. They dominated fundamentally, not all of them, but they played a central role in the, in formulating the position of the left. So they used the Communist Party, which had attraction, which had roots in Iran, and they were highly, you know, intelligent and experienced people.
And they were pro-Moscow, right? They were pro-Soviet
Union. Exactly.
Yes.
They were pro-Moscow. They were very much motivated by a reductionist ideology. So what I want to say is that the clerics used the fragmentation of the left and the liberal, and Rafsanjani, because he knew both sides, he more than any other cleric, Rafsanjani was familiar with the position of the left, with the position of religious nationalists, with the position of National Front, with the position of independent leftists. So Rafsanjani was a key player, in my opinion, in teaching Khomeini, instructing Khomeini how to use the differences and the divisions among the liberals in order to eliminate them one by one. If you ask me, even someone like Banisadr, some even elements of the National Front were used against Bazargan. And once they eliminated Bazargan, came Banisadr. They had to eliminate him. And they were not personalities only. They represented certain significant sectors of the urban middle class. Hmm. So Rafsanjani, being aware of this background, played a central role in marginalizing and gradually eliminating the liberal and the leftist competition.
Going back to the same period, he has been described as the number two man in the Iranian regime for a period of 3 decades almost, following the 1979 revolution.
Right.
The leader of the populist movement that toppled the Shah's regime was Ayatollah Khomeini. In 1980s, when Ayatollah Khomeini was still alive, Rafsanjani was considered by many to be his right-hand man. Of all the revolutionaries who were involved and the people who were close to Khomeini, how did he achieve such prominence?
He was a real political animal. And I'm not necessarily using it in a negative way at all.
Sure. Politically shrewd, yes.
Power. he understood what issues would resonate at any given time. In other words, he was a lot less ideological than people like Khomeini and the rest. The vast majority of the clerics who entered politics in the beginning, they were very ideological. They were genuine believers. I would say Rafsanjani was a master player among clerics in understanding politics and ideology and how to use one and the other in pursuit of consolidation of power and his own position. And also he was very interested in money. He died as one of the richest men in Iran. Remember that over the past 38 years, we definitely have a new class of rich people. And when we get that by reading the newspapers of the regime itself, Rafsanjani was a central figure in this group. And where did the money come from? Largely through its rentier estate, through contact with government, important export, and definitely oil money. So Rafsanjani, you know, he had something in common with Donald Trump. Believe it or not, yes, no, without any question, yes, that he understood money and business, sure, and how people related money and business. He was also very deeply interested in power. And it was his ability to combine the two that gave him more influence than any other cleric around Khomeini.
Professor Farhang, in 1981, the regime unleashed a wave of terror against the opposition that was unprecedented in modern Iranian history. It's a dark period. Mr. Rafsanjani, at the time, he was the number two man in the power structure.
Rafsanjani was very much involved in the committing criminal acts, terror, against Iranian dissidents, both inside and outside the country. That's why, in Germany, he was actually officially by the German court accused of being a participant in killing, the Mekanus killing, and killing of Qasem Lu and the rest. And not only that, in his entire life, he never said a word critical of imprisoning anybody, torturing anybody, executing anybody. And yet, he was clever enough to be a man behind the scene. He was clever enough to not to be as closely associated with terror, with violence against the opposition, as, for example, Khomeini was, as even Khomeini was. But even after Ayatollah Montazeri's son revealed the conversation his father had with the prosecutors and the judges who had executed over 3,000 political prisoners in Iran, many of them had been in prison for 10 years, for 5 years, 6 years.
This is the 1988 massacre.
Some of those kids were arrested in the street in 1979 and 1980. They were college students, even high school students. Even after Ayatollah Montazeri exposed the tape, exposed what had actually happened, both in his writing first, but particularly in the tape, Rafsanjani never said a critical word about it. Only Khatami said something about it, very, very mild.
But this is former President Khatami.
Former President Khatami. They busted Ayatollah Montazeri's son and they have convicted him to years in prison. Rafsanjani, he was a player in every sense of the word in the use of violence against opposition, both inside and outside the country, eliminating them and all that, particularly even eliminating people within the regime, people like Khoeiniha, for example. Khoeiniha and his friends, the Salam newspaper, economically speaking, they were more interested in moving toward a kind of a state-dominated economy, and Rafsanjani very much of a free marketer. So he played a significant role in eliminating them and completely expelling them from the regime. But the most incredible thing about this guy was that he was not upfront, and he didn't claim influence. He didn't brag about what he did, but he was a central and significant decision maker.
Just to be clear, that between 1981 and 83, the regime executed thousands of political prisoners in Iran. They imprisoned and tortured thousands and thousands of people?
Actually, recently, for the piece with respect to, I did some research about Amnesty International Human Rights Watch, International Federation of Human Rights, and other organizations, including the UN. And over the past 38 years, the Iranian regime has executed more than 15,000 political prisoners.
Amnesty International has a figure close to 4,000 for just the events that took place during those five months in summer of 1988.
Some of them were in prison for 8 years since the beginning. They were busted in, when the Mujahideen started, or the leftists demonstrated in the streets. And when those kids were arrested on the street, they were never released until Khomeini decided to execute.
And this tragic episode has been described by a prominent Iranian scholar, historian, Professor Abrahamian, what he calls a baptism in blood. This was a time for the regime to see who is on their side and who is not, creating a cohesion within the regime. And it seems like Rafsanjani and others decided to go along with it. I mean, they were
absolutely. It's, at that time, if Khomeini had decided to do it, you know, Rafsanjani would go along. You know, not doing it wouldn't particularly serve his interest.
As you mentioned, Kurdish leader Qasemlu was assassinated in Vienna in 1991.
Oh, absolutely. Bakhtiar
was assassinated in Paris in 1991. And in the same year, there was the assassination of Kurdish leaders in Berlin.
But this was the time that, you know, even...
And Rafsanjani was the president at the time, and he's...
You know, in 1984, when I was teaching at, you know, Bennington College, I was contacted by the FBI telling me that they had discovered some Iranian, as a result of violence the embassy had committed in Germany, that there were a list of a number of people to be assassinated in the United States, and I was on the list. And I actually wrote a piece about it in the New York Times. Then they came actually to the college, the FBI agent came to the college and said, you know, we have found this and your name was on it and your information about you, everything was in the paper. We are here to let you know. I was in Bennington, the FBI agent came from Rutland, Vermont, and he gave me a telephone number.
Sure.
I said, whenever you feel any kind of a threat, please give us a call immediately.
Rafsanjani, during his 8 year as a president, in the wake of the war with Iraq, he was labeled by some as being the commander of construction. So his priority was, as he claims it, to be economic development.
Right.
There was no interest in any sort of political opening or democratization of the society.
Absolutely not. In fact, he succeeded. In fact, he was powerful enough, as you probably remember, that I think it was in 1995, I mean, after he came to, it was during the beginning of the second term of his presidency that he signed an agreement, a $1 billion agreement with Conoco, and President Clinton vetoed it.
Yes, that was the time that sanctions were imposed on Iran.
Exactly, yeah. And he was definitely at the time influenced by the Israelis, yeah. And sanctions were beginning. So he vetoed it. So Rafsanjani, that was a real setback for Rafsanjani. He was hoping that if he could make a $1 billion deal with Conoco, that would be a great opening to normalize economic and trade relations with the West. But at that time, it was the United States that turned him down.
He was always considered as a moderate, so-called moderate, by Western European and U.S. journalists. People in the corridors of power in Washington and Western European capitals, they consider him as a moderate element. But this moderation really was referring to him as his approach to the United States and the West. Obviously, has nothing to do with his
economic and trade. Two things. One, they were very much aware of his interest in free market and normalization of Iran's economic and trade relations with the Western world. But this equally important was the way he talked to journalists, the way he talked to foreigners. He never referred to, you know, God and prophet and all that. He really talked like a politician, like a pragmatic character. So he also knew how to talk to Western reporters and Western visitors and Western business in the people. So based on the conversation they had with him, and definitely they were persuaded this man wants to make a deal economically and politically, they considered him a moderate. And if moderation is defined only in terms of at least economically satisfying the Western world, yes, he was a moderate. But if we are talking about the national interest of Iran, if we are talking about civil liberties and human rights and so forth. He was as uncompromising as anyone else in the regime.
Mansour Farhang is Professor Emeritus of International Relations at Bennington College. He was Iran's first ambassador to the United Nations after the revolution. You can hear the expanded version of this interview at vomina.org. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. شکفته بهارون گل سرخ خورشید باز اومد و شب شد گریزون گل سرخ خورشید باز اومد و شب شد گریزون کوها لاله زارن لاله ها بیدارن تو کوها دارن گل 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 آفتاب و میکارن دارن گل 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 آفتاب و میکارن توی کوهستون دلش میداره تفنگ و گل و گندم داره میاره توی سینش جان 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 توی سینش جان جان جان. Next, we go to Chicago to speak with Kaveh Ehsani, Assistant Professor of International Studies at DePaul University in Chicago, about the late Rafsanjani's new liberal policies and how his economic agenda shaped Iran's economic landscape.
The end of Iran-Iraq war and the death of Ayatollah Khomeini soon after marked the end of the populist phase of the 1979 revolution. And the economy at the time was more or less bankrupt and the population was impoverished. Mr. Hashemi Rafsanjani, who had been elected president in 1989, led a transition from the populist phase and a more or less redistributive state of 1980s into a new liberal state, capitalism. Can you talk about the condition of the Iranian economy after 8 years of a devastating war, and what prompted this transition into a new liberal phase?
Well, I mean, as you said, the Iran-Iraq war was hugely disruptive. You know, there were a million casualties that we know of. Of those, about 250,000 were killed. The rest were maimed or been wounded and so on and so forth. Many cities, basically the whole entire west of the country, which was neighboring Iraq, had been destroyed in the war. In the revolution, you had a major flight of capital. Political disruptions meant that the economy wasn't really functioning. The state had taken over many of the industries that had been owned and assets that had been owned by the monarchic elite. So you basically had a major phase, the decade after the revolution, where the economy had been significantly damaged. The estimates run to about $1 trillion to $1.5 trillion equivalent at the time of the damage to the economy. Having said this, at the same time, you know, there had been a lot of redistribution. So poor people, rural people, migrants, refugees were basically functioning in a sort of a nascent welfare state where the new state felt responsible and beholden to take care of the population. So this was kind of a very significant period in Iranian history where in 1989, with the death of Khomeini and the rewriting of the constitution, a major decision had to be made about what to do with the aftermath of the war. Because basically, as Rafsanjani said it more coherently than anybody else, he said, look, you know, we had the legitimacy of Khomeinism and the populism that drove us through the war, but we basically lost the war. And at this stage, we need to re-legitimize ourselves by normalizing the economy. People can't live on slogans and on utopian aspirations and revolutionary aspirations anymore. They want normality. They want a material life. We're in a position where we have to rebuild the infrastructure, which has been completely devastated. There was no electricity, no drinking water. There was a huge population increase because the rate of population growth was around 4%. So there were a number of things came together in 1989, right after Khomeini's passing, that basically set Iran toward a major course change to deal with the economy and the politics of the country. So they passed this 5-year development plan in 1989. Whereas before, in the 1980s, there was this whole rhetoric of attacking and sidelining experts, professional experts, as compromised politically and relying on people who were committed ideologically to the revolution. Now the state began to talk about the need for developing its own professional class, but with revolutionary credentials and faithful to the revolution. So they really kind of began to expand the education system, the public health system. There was a major effort to bring population growth under control and to rebuild the economy, basically by reducing sanctions and making sure that there was investment being made in infrastructure primarily. So energy production, road networks, the urban infrastructure, and so on and so forth became really the priority at all costs. Until then, Iran really didn't have any foreign debt because it was considered to be a political taboo to become dependent on foreign capital. But Rafsanjani took the bold step of reaching out to the World Bank and global financial institutions to bring in investment and loans. I recall it was about $30-40 billion of loans that Iran took in 1989 to 1992, and it became a big controversy. And a lot of this was invested in infrastructure, you know, educational, social, public health, and as well as material urban infrastructure. So yes, you're right that he really kind of was responsible for shifting the economy from redistributive toward a market-oriented, government-sponsored, highly capital-intensive phase of reconstruction after the war.
Kaveh, everybody talks about Rafsanjani's government embracing structural adjustment policies. And you just mentioned that state planners included privatization as a basis for this 5-year plan. But it seems like the privatization of industries and financial assets remained negligible, at least for another decade or so. But at the same time, it was clear that the ruling bloc was ready to do a structural adjustment program. Just to be clear, when we are talking about structural adjustment, which has limited privatization, what are the signifiers of such program?
You're right that there was rhetoric of privatization, but it's important to remember that the Islamic Republic was never against the private sector. Actually, private property is sacred in Islam. However, this was a big debate within the ruling elite, you know, because some were much more in favor of a large public sector and government control of the economy. They were socialistic in their outlook, while other factions, actually, ironically, the more traditionalist factions, were much more in favor of an unfettered private sector. So, you know, they were at odds with each other. And with Rafsanjani's ascent to presidency in 89, basically the traditionalists won the argument, the economic argument. And the idea that the market should be the criteria for evaluating the economy became much more accepted. Now, you're correct that Iran's constitution and laws were very convoluted in terms of to what extent private property and the market should be self-governing and free. Nevertheless, you know, this is not the only way that structural adjustment happened in Iran. The way it happened was that most of the major state institutions were directed to basically justify their budget based on market criteria. In other words, now suddenly all ministries had to kind of have a budget and show a profit. They had to be self-sustaining. They had to show that their revenues were covering their expenses. And therefore, they began to shift toward the commercial perception. And this was hugely problematic. For example, the Ministry of Intelligence, which has to do with counter-espionage and internal security and gathering of intelligence and all that, suddenly had to kind of justify its budget by beginning to make money. So they began to kind of get involved in commercial projects like housing development and import-export business and so on and so forth. And you can see that this is hugely problematic because if intelligence ministry or the military or the health ministry or education ministry has to kind of think along commercial lines of making profit, then they have to cut their costs and they have to show at any cost a surplus at the end of the year in order to justify the kind of budget that they're getting, that they're contributing to the state treasury and they're taking their share out of it. So corruption, basically undermining and ditching all sorts of social obligations that these ministries and institutions had before, became the order of the day. So, for example, the Tehran municipality, which is not really a governmental institution, it's a semi-private, semi-public institution, has its own rules, it's under the tutelage of the Ministry of Interior, but it really is a huge institution that governs the city of Tehran, which is 9 million populations. Suddenly they had to kind of begin to make a profit in order to justify their budget. So they began to break the law. For example, the urban laws in Tehran decreed that the density of construction in the city should be basically at one story or two story buildings. They began to break this law and issue, in exchange for money, these permits for speculators basically to come and build high rises without neighborhoods or without the urban fabric being prepared for it at all. So basically within one generation, the city of Tehran went from this flat, low-build metropolis to a city of high-rises. Cost of housing, the cost of living began to increase exponentially, and the municipality was making huge profits out of it and became a major speculator in the urban land market. And the same story goes with a lot of other public institutions. So even though you didn't really have privatization per se, structural adjustment meant that all the public institutions began to think like corporations and like commercial ventures and began to overlook the tasks that they had for in whatever area they were functioning and really focus on making money, making a profit. And a lot of this came from basically letting go of their employees or terminating permanent contracts or beginning to create casual labor markets, hiring people without any contract on really low pay, without benefits, because that's a lot cheaper to run. So one of the byproducts of this approach to structural adjustment was a massive increase of unemployment and or the change of the labor market into a very precarious labor market where people had temporary jobs, they were on temporary contracts, they had no job protection, the labor laws began to change and really kind of take away protection from workers, from employees, and so on and so forth. And this was really controversial in a state that had come out of a revolution which really kind of called for social justice and protection under the law.
The state, in a sense, in this period, in 1989 through 90s, became essentially the sponsor of a speculative boom, if you like. And so in a way, one can argue, and I think you have argued in your work, this is privatization of the urban skyline.
Right.
That these are public assets that have been privatized.
Yes, yes it was. But we have to remember that the way that the Iranian economy works is that the largest and most massive functioning private sector is in commerce, and it's in real estate. You also have a market in agricultural land, but really there's not a lot of speculation that takes place in it unless villages and areas surrounding cities become integrated into the city. Then you start seeing agricultural land turning into housing and speculation over housing. The other sectors of the economy, industry, services, are not necessarily as massively privatized. So the largest, least cumbersome sector where the private capital can move into is urban housing and commerce and trade. Other than that, the other segments of the economy, heavy industries, for example, even medium-sized industries, although they're mostly privatized, it's much more difficult to make money in them, to accumulate profits and capital in them, because they're much more subject to stringent regulation, state regulation, and all these webs of laws that really kind of try to control them. So naturally, for a really quick profit, a lot of capital moves into real estate, construction, and trade. It's only in recent years, since a stock market has been established, that some investment and some capital has started moving into industries and so on and so forth. So I'd say that large chunks of Iran's economy remain privatized in name only, because you have basically these shadow companies set up from within the government sector itself. The public sector basically ditches out. So you have bureaucrats or state employees that go out and establish a front company. and then take over parts of the ministry and the public sector that they were part of, relying on their public connections and their political connections to get cheap loans. And often they don't return these loans. So, yes, you do have some kind of privatization in industrial sectors, but it's really kind of corrupt. It's questionable to what extent it's really competitive, real privatization, or is this kind of semi-privatization that is really kind of woven into the mafia-type web of political connections that really comes out of the state itself.
That campaign of privatization somewhat escalated under Ahmadinejad's tenure.
Yes, between 2005 and 2009-10, we had this, the lifting of the blockage on privatization, but then this was a time where oil revenues were at their height. The banking system and the state treasury were really flush with money. They lifted a lot of control on revenues and on financial capital, and they basically loaned out to their clients and their allies huge and vast sums of money with very little regulation to basically go out and buy off vast swaths of public assets like factories and land and companies and so on and so forth. So you had privatization of a very corrupt nature, a very questionable nature, and the state basically ended up really being robbed because a lot of the loans and finances that were given out to people to kind of privatize these or buy these companies and assets were never returned because there was very little regulation and political connections were behind these outlays. Since Rouhani's government has come to power, there's all this discussion about vast sums missing from the treasury with no accountability as to where they went or where the oil money or oil revenues that came in, how they disappeared into these corrupt networks.
This kind of privatization sort of resembles what happened in the aftermath of the collapse of Soviet Union.
Yeah, there are similarities, in some major similarities. There are similarities with what happened in China, with the difference that in China you have, what you've had is huge direct foreign investment. You know, what China offered was very little regulation on labor and land. So you had all these communes that were effectively privatized by their leaders. But then they benefited from foreign capital coming in. And the difference in Iran was that there was really no foreign capital coming in. It was oil revenues that were coming in because, you know, under sanctions, Iran was really not in a position to attract foreign capital. So you didn't have international corporations that would at least impose accountability or bring in new industries or new ventures. I mean, you know, so you didn't have General Motors or Nissan coming and building a factory and then overseeing it under questionable situation conditions. But nevertheless, you do not have the same scale of actual new industrial and commercial and economic ventures getting started. So you had a lot of speculative economic activity with money changing hand with very little real outcome for the economy as a whole.
Going back to Rafsanjani's undertaking in terms of a shift in strategy and economic paradigm, can you tell us which classes and social forces provided the base of support for this shift?
Well, in my reading, I think the period of, you know, 1990s really produced a massive new professional middle class in Iran. There were two prongs to this. Two significant segments of the population really benefited from the post-war construction. The first were people who went to universities and got degrees, and the symbolic capital of having a professional degree that would allow them to join the professional labor market. Just the figures are astounding. So if you look, for example, Iran was producing something like 250,000 university graduates prior to the revolution in 1979. By mid-1990s, that number had increased tenfold to 2.5 to 3 million. So in every small village and town, you had a university, one or two or even sometimes three university campuses. Some were universities by correspondence. They were not particularly good universities. The quality of the teaching was not necessarily good, but the accreditation was there. So these universities were often for profit. They produced a massive number of graduates and professional classes, doctors, sociologists, psychologists, engineers, and so on and so forth, that suddenly could look forward to a professional career. And they benefited from this. The numbers are quite staggering. Now, many of them can't find jobs because the economy is in doldrums, and this has created its own crisis. But nevertheless, they were beneficiaries, because if they hadn't gone to university, they would remain farmers or urban lower middle class with little chance of moving up into the professional ladder. So that's a professional middle class that was created. The second group that vastly benefited were people who happened to have property in cities and towns. So with the schemes that came with the municipalities and the demand for housing and all that, these people basically cashed in by turning their small land plots into high rises. And suddenly, if you had a single family home and you could turn it into 10, 15 small apartments and sell them at a huge profit, you would make a huge profit. So suddenly you started getting a significant number of people who were lucky enough to have small plots of land or houses in cities that suddenly became owners of a lot of money that they could invest and become investors and capitalists and entrepreneurs themselves. Then you had people who were basically in the bazaar sector, in the merchant class, that really benefited. And then you had people well connected within the public sector who could get cheap loans and or easy permits to get involved in small ventures and so on and so forth. So these people vastly benefited, but there were significant losers as well in the process. You know, you had migrants coming to cities who basically couldn't find housing or suddenly had to live in a superheated rental market that really there were no supplies. Workers, people on fixed income, you know, all these people really began to suffer with the rising inflation and the tightening labor market and the fact that economic opportunities were really not there to take care of them. Then you also had the government that was withdrawing from its responsibility, welfare responsibility. So a lot of people really suffered in the process. They were impoverished effectively, but also there were, you had a lot of beneficiaries, and including these new urban professional middle classes that didn't exist really on that scale in the 1980s or prior to the revolution.
This urban middle class was supposed to be, the way it was planned, it was supposed to be a loyal class to drive this new strategy. It was supposed to be Islamic. It was supposed to be a neoliberal class. But it didn't actually turn out that way, did it? It wasn't, the 2009 protest did not show its loyalty to the political establishment.
That's correct. This professional middle class is really a global class. This is the global class of 21st century. People who go to university, get a degree, become a physician or something, or an engineer or an economist, really are an economist first and foremost. And that global class has really its own expectations. I would argue that it is neoliberal, you know, fundamentally, because if you look at the discourse and the worldviews of the middle classes, I mean, just look at the American middle class nowadays, you know, professional middle class. They really have no critique of the market system. They really have no distance from actually existing consumer capitalism. They're a product of it, and they're part of it. You know, they really don't have any distance from it, at present at least, until matters get a lot worse and people start thinking that, well, you know, we have to think of alternatives. Iran was not really different in that sense. The young people who went to universities, got degrees, became professionals. And we have to kind of add to this that 50-60% of them were women. They began to kind of think in terms of meritocracy. I'm entitled to a job, and I'm better qualified for it than somebody who has political connections and doesn't have a degree to run an office or run a business and so on and so forth. So they had their own expectations. They wanted the standard of living that they kind of acquired by entertainment, media, and so on and so forth, looking, you know, like everybody does in the world nowadays, in China, in the U.S., and so on and so forth. You want a TV, you want your own apartment, you want to have an income, disposable income, you want to go on tourism. All those aspects of consumption, everyday life, work habits, and so on and so forth is what they were trained with, and there was very little Islamic about it.
It's clear that this class is, as you said, it's new liberal in mindset, but it's neither Islamic nor loyal to the dominant discourse within the political establishment.
Yeah, I would argue that although the faction in Iran that is called reformist is also very much the spokesman for this generation and for this social class. So, you know, I would say that the idea, the big political tension in Iran at present is between both sides are loyal to the system to some extent. But the question is, to what extent will the system change to accommodate these differences? So the people who are kind of known as traditionalists in Iran are people who really are closest to the military security establishment. They don't have the university degrees necessarily, or they don't inhabit the same kind of cultural domain that the more secularized middle classes inhabit. So they want to maintain the system because it's really benefiting them. Whereas the other professional young, you know, just talking about young people, you know, the young professional new classes, middle classes, really want to be normal according to the norms that are established elsewhere in the world, you know, where you don't have a radical Islamic regime like you do in Iran. So they want more normalization. Now, to what extent are they absolutely against the regime itself, and are they revolutionary or not? That's another question.
Kaveh, you clearly identified one of the drivers of this new liberal strategy under Rafsanjani's tenure. What about the capitalist class? How did the war economy and a large transfer of public land in the 80s and into private hands, as well as the war economy itself, benefited those who had control over state institutions and economic foundations?
Well, that's a complex question. So, for example, look at the oil sector, which is the largest sector in the Iranian economy. I mean, contrary to popular belief, you know, Iran's economy is vast. Oil revenues form 20% of the GDP. They form a big part of the much bigger portion of the state budget or state government revenues. But really, as part of the Iranian economy, 20% is linked to hydrocarbons, you know, oil, gas, refineries, petrochemicals, and so on and so forth. So there's been a lot of discussion about privatizing this, and people who have managed to basically set up companies and become involved in this vast complex of oil and gas related ventures are primarily people who have close political ties to the ruling establishment. So, for example, the downstream of oil sector. So this is from pumping stations to companies basically subcontracted to carry out all the work that takes place in the oil industry after extraction, after the oil wells, which are government-owned. You go to refineries, you go to petrochemicals, so you have many, many different operations that are taking place. Most of these are nominally privatized now. So, for example, if in the refinery sector you had one government authority to basically run all refineries, now you have something like 150 smaller private companies, nominally private companies. But when you start looking into these private companies, you realize that the shareholders are mutual funds, retirement funds, they're banks, you know, government-owned banks. They're companies set up by segments of the military or cooperatives that are part of this industry or that industry. So nominally, these owning blocks act along commercial lines. But really, if you start scratching the surface, you realize that they're effectively semi-public, or they're set up by people who have a foot in the government sector and have set up these shadow companies that now have ownership, nominal ownership of these subsectors of the oil industry. This is the oil industry, but if you move on to the energy sector, to the agricultural sector, there are variations. You know, Iran's economy is quite large, is quite wide. There's some more sectors that have become more competitive, but by and large, political connections and political links play a huge role in all sectors of the economy that are profitable. And this has become a real problem because it's creating corruption, it's creating dysfunctional and unproductive and inefficiencies on a vast scale. And the other downside of it is that people who work in these sectors, you know, laborers, you know, workers, employees, and so on and so forth, have very little protection because they're the first to suffer every time that these companies want to become profitable. They basically trample the right of workers and their employees. So labor problems and, by extension, class conflict has become a more and more acute aspect of Iran's economy. A lot of the discontent that you get are not necessarily from owners of these corporations, but are from their employees who are not getting paid, who have very kind of shaky contracts, who don't get any benefits, who are not under protection of labor laws or welfare laws anymore.
Kaveh, from 1991 to 1994, we saw six major unrests in Shiraz, Iraq, Mashhad, Qazvin, and Tabriz. And there were other minor clashes in many other urban centers in Iran. Many of these incidents involve urban squatters concerned with the destruction in their communities. How do you assess these riots in light of the new liberal shift that we spoke about earlier?
You talked about four upheavals or riots. You know, there were many, many more, many smaller ones, quite recurring, and they continue today as well. So yes, urban unrest and these upheavals have become a recurring feature of Iran's politics, even though they don't really get covered that much. They point out to a couple of things. First is that the political system is not really responsive to demands of people for housing, for services, or for other things that lead to these kinds of discontent. So if, for example, drinking water is contaminated because in southern Tehran, because the refinery is not treating its pollutants correctly and it's seeping into the aquifer and it's polluting people's drinking water, they have no recourse. Aside from their member of the parliament, they have no other representative, because local authorities in Iran are really responsive only to the central authority. They're not elected, they're not accountable to their locality, they shift quite often, and usually their personnel are appointed and sent from the center, because the government fears that if locals get appointed to local positions of authority, then they have their own local connections and they will undermine the central government's authority. So, you know, people, employees, governors, prefects, police station chiefs, and so on and so forth, these are people who travel around. They get posted for periods of 2 years or 3 years, and then they get shifted to another province, another town. So they never have local roots established. And by extension, local people don't feel like these people understand their problems or are responsive to them. How do you decentralize authority and representation in Iran is a huge issue that is often overlooked and not understood. The other side of it is that if you look at the nature of a lot of these local upheavals and discontent, it has to do with the fact that the central government comes up with these ideas about big national projects that are supposed to benefit the country as a whole, but they really screw over local populations. There's this argument that, well, instead of importing sugar, we need to build vast sugarcane plantations in a province called Khuzestan in southwestern Iran, because there's a lot of river water, surface water there.
Sure.
And they do this, and they dispossess a huge number of local farmers. The project polluted the drinking water of three major cities downstream. And then there were these other parallel projects to build these vast aqueducts and shift the water from this province to the central provinces because of drought and because there were water shortages in central provinces, right?
Right.
So local populations really reacted to this, and
sure,
you had multiple riots in cities like Khorramshahr, Abadan. These are cities that really suffered during the Iran-Iraq War and are quite significant and important and large cities with historical roots in Iran and so on and so forth. So local people felt really resentful because they thought, well, our water is getting polluted. Now it's being shifted to provinces elsewhere because those provinces have better political connections to the central government. These are kind of anecdotal examples, but in most cases of urban riots, you see laws, development projects, policies that are decided at the center at the expense of local populations in the name of national priorities and national benefit that really kind of undermine the livelihood and the welfare and the well-being of local populations. And part of it is that local populations, provincials, rural people feel that they really have no say in the government, and they feel really kind of alienated and marginalized in the process.
Kaveh Sani is an assistant professor of international studies at DePaul University in Chicago. He spoke with Shahram Aghamir. You can hear the expanded version of this interview at vomina.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Naomi Klein. Change the system, not the climate. Naomi Klein is best known for her book, This Changes Everything, Capitalism versus the Climate. She wrote, "It's not about carbon, it's about capitalism. And we can seize this existential crisis to transform our failed economic system and build something radically better." An important document to its building a better future is the LEAP Manifesto. It calls for a restructuring of the Canadian economy and an end to the use of fossil fuels. The LEAP Manifesto was initiated in the spring of 2015 at a two-day meeting in Toronto. Among those who wrote it were representatives from Canada's Indigenous rights, social and food justice, environmental, faith-based, and labor movements. Naomi Klein gives a summary of the manifesto in the talk you are about to hear, a manifesto that can play a role in other countries as well. Naomi Klein was recorded at the Grand Conference, Change the System, Not the Climate, in August 2016, in Canada. Most of us know Naomi Klein from her frequent visits to the U.S., but it is moving to hear her speak at home, engage with criticism of Justin Trudeau, express her allegiance with the Indigenous base, and even find out why she was born in Montreal, not in the U.S.
Alors, recevons Naomi Klein, je vous prie.
Merci, Roger. Bonjour et bienvenue, tout le monde. We are on Indigenous land, the traditional territory of the Haudenosaunee people and the Algonquin people. Those of you who traveled great distances to be here, welcome. Those of you who had wanted to attend the forum as participants, as speakers, who were registered but denied visas by the Canadian government, you are deeply missed. Shame indeed. I was at the first World Social Forum in Porto Alegre 15 years ago. And now I've been to the first World Social Forum, because this is not a World Social Forum. Not when 70% of the people from the Global South who applied for visas were denied visas. Canada, I'm afraid, is not as seen on TV. Apparently, the Canadian government was worried that the World Social Forum delegates would overstay their visas. Never mind that the delegates applying for those visas from places like Mali and Palestine and Ecuador are the last people likely to overstay their visas and try to move to Canada. These are political leaders and community organizers of the first order intensely committed to changing their homelands. That commitment is what unites so many people who are here. The tourists from the U.S., on the other hand, these are the ones vowing to move to Canada if Donald Trump is elected. I keep my eye on them. I keep my eye on them. Now, I shouldn't joke about this, because this is something that I actually know a little bit about. I was born in this city in 1970 because my father, a U.S. citizen, did not want to be a soldier in the Vietnam War. Under Justin Trudeau's father, my parents were waved through the border and were free to stay and build their lives here. But Canada is not like that today. In fact, there are dozens of U.S. soldiers and veterans who have fled to Canada over the past 12 years because they refused to fight an illegal war in Iraq. And here, they have faced deportation, legal harassment, and live in limbo, constantly afraid that they will be deported and jailed in the United States. It began under our last government, but nothing has changed so far for Iraq war resistors. And let me state the obvious. These men and women are heroes. They stood up to the most powerful military force on earth, refusing to be complicit in war crimes, refusing to fight a war for oil, which has a little to do with climate change, our topic tonight. These issues are all interconnected. A digression, perhaps, but it's an important reminder how much easier it is to change a country's image than it is to change its policies. How much more comfortable neoliberal politicians are with progressive marketing and small, largely symbolic steps than with the substantive work of system change. But nothing less than system change will allow us to do what's necessary to avert catastrophic warming in the short time that remains. And because we live in a time when politics is treated as a spectator sport, it's always important to remember that our fragile atmosphere is utterly indifferent to cheering and hugging politicians at international summits. Same goes for small steps in the right direction, which we're always told we should accept, and that's all we are allowed to demand. All that matters is now how much carbon is allowed to accumulate year on year. The rest is just noise. Some of you will recall that Canada made quite an impression during the Paris Climate Summit last December. Canada stood with some of the most vulnerable countries in the world and argued that the temperature target in the agreement should not be to keep warming below 2 degrees Celsius, but that it should be 1.5, and we got some of that language in the agreement. That was a proud moment for Canada, and Justin Trudeau said, "Canada is back." Remember that? And that's true. Back to the same old tricks. Trudeau and his ministers returned home and joined with the Alberta government to push new tar sands pipelines like Energy East that would endanger water systems in this province and in this very city. That mega pipeline, that $16 billion pipeline, is utterly incompatible with the temperature targets that we ourselves championed, because it is linked to massive expansion of one of the dirtiest sources of carbon on the planet, the Alberta tar sands. And scientists have told us that if we're serious about 2 degrees, 80% of it has to stay in the ground, more for 1.5. Our government did this for a simple reason. It may want to do the right thing when it comes to climate. I have no doubt that they do. But when it comes to economics, it is still locked within a logic that seeks economic growth at all costs and is terrified of real industrial planning or, God forbid, advocating reduced consumption among wealthy over consumers. So, Canadians are asked to live with the cognitive dissonance of saying one thing to the world and doing precisely the opposite at home. In truth, this is familiar territory. Canada is founded on broken treaties. Ask any Indigenous person on Turtle Island. Breaking our sacred word is a national tradition. It's heritage, and it will continue unless we as social movements band together and stop it inside Canada and around the world, particularly those movements in nations that are most impacted by climate change, and this is a movement that must be led by Indigenous people in this country. Perhaps it seems I'm being overly hard on the Trudeau government. It's much better than the last gang with their permanent snarl. This government's unofficial slogan, those of you who are from out of town, is sunny ways. Well, we need more than sunny ways. We need solar power, and we need it everywhere, with that power generation owned in common by communities and not by private players. But, of course, to do that, we would need to break all the rules in the neoliberal playbook, and that's why this discussion is about the need for system change if we are going to be serious about climate change. We need to stand up to those fossil fuel giants and the banks that fund them. We need to take back our energy grids from private players. We need to embrace our right to plan our economies. And we must wage war on the logic of austerity, which is itself at war with life on Earth. There are more ways that climate change highlights the need for system change, and our wonderful panelists tonight are going to be getting into more detail. Another example, all this green talk in the world doesn't matter if our governments keep pushing trade deals like the TPP, TTIP, and CETA, which allow corporations to sue our governments when they do the right thing and stand up to multinational corporations. You know, TransCanada currently is suing the U.S. government for saying no to the Keystone XL pipeline. They want $15 billion in damages. Quebec provided an early warning for all of this, because Quebec was one of the first regions in the world to pass a fracking moratorium. And it was a historic movement-led victory, and it inspired people around the world. But there is a gas company, pretending actually to be a U.S. gas company, that is using NAFTA to challenge the Quebec fracking ban, is seeking damages. It claims that it violates its right to frack for gas under the St. Lawrence. So these are a few of the ways that climate change changes everything. It changes it because our current economic and political system blocks meaningful climate action at every turn, which means that system change is a matter of survival. Trudeau is a good student. He studied Obama. He knows how to look cool while selling arms to repressive regimes and peddling job-killing trade deals. He thinks we're going to be satisfied with parades and weekly viewings of his pecs. No matter how grave the problem, the war waged on the bodies of Indigenous women, indefinite detention of migrants, the climate crisis, the water crisis, the solution is always the same: consultation, further study, inquiry. Meaningful action is always off in the distance. Words and pictures, words and pictures. Mots et des images, mots et des images. Well, someone needs to tell our selfie-loving PM that we are up against the wall. And words and pictures aren't going to cut it, because this moment in our history, this is the era of the deed. Ceci est l'ère de l'action. When it comes to climate change, that means doing whatever it takes to bring down greenhouse gas emissions, not incrementally, but radically. For wealthy countries like Canada, if we're going to do our share, we need to be cutting our emissions by 10% a year. That's huge. That's unprecedented. So call it what you will, a Green New Deal, a great transition, a Marshall Plan for planet Earth, but make no mistake, this is a civilizational mission, not an add-on, one more item to add to a governmental to-do list, some special interest to satisfy. But let me stress something else. It is also not about saying that climate change is so big and so urgent that it should trump everything else. Like, first we'll save the planet and then we'll worry about poverty and inequality and racism. No. That's how we lose. That's how we divide ourselves. What we need to do is recognize that we live in a time of overlapping, intersectional crises. Yes, the climate crisis, but also the crisis of institutionalized racism, the crisis of economic exclusion on a massive level, the crisis of militarism. And we need to design and then fight like hell for integrated solutions, ones that radically bring down emissions at the same time as they create huge numbers of unionized jobs and deliver meaningful justice to Indigenous people and other communities that have gotten the worst deal under the current extractive economy. And in North America, that overwhelmingly means communities of color. In other words, system change. The good news is that change is in the air. We see evidence of it everywhere, from the incredible rise of social movements like Black Lives Matter, I Don't Know More, No One Is Illegal, fearlessly taking on state and corporate power. And we see it in the political sphere. We see it with Bernie Sanders' historic campaign to lead the Democratic Party. Bernie showed that what for decades was unsayable can now be said out loud. Free college tuition, double the minimum wage, 100% renewable energy, and the crowds cheered. He almost won. We saw it. We see it. Yeah, I think that deserves a... We see it in Jeremy Corbyn's rise to the leadership of the British Labour Party. and the determination of his supporters to keep him there despite relentless attacks and subversion. We see it in the rise of Podemos in Spain, in the election of Syriza in Greece, even in the global popularity of Pope Francis, who speaks about capitalism as a cancer. This is a huge shift. The intellectual fencing that has constrained the left's imagination for so long lies twisted on the ground. It began, in a sense, at the first World Social Forum 15 years ago. I covered that forum for The Nation, and I wrote at the time that this marked the end of history, this lie that we had been told, that it was all over, that there was only one way to run the world now. Those were the first cracks in the facade, and then came the 2008 financial crisis, which threw a brick through the window. Suddenly, there was no one left to defend neoliberalism on its ideological merits. That doesn't mean it's dead. They smuggle it in post-crisis, from post-Brexit UK to post-coup Brazil to post-failed coup in Turkey. Any crisis will do. But just because one ideological project has lost the argument does not mean that a better one automatically rises up to replace it. As much as we celebrate our victories, we also have to be honest with ourselves. Have we put forward a genuine alternative worldview, one powerful enough to rival capitalism, to rival extractivism? There is no question. We've gotten very good at saying no. No to austerity, to imperialism, to corporate trade deals, to new wars. But 15 years after the end of history, left governments are in crisis from Caracas to Athens, increasingly in conflict with the social movements that brought them to power, that know they're better than the alternative, but also that they're not good enough. And that's partly because the left imagination, while slowly freeing itself from neoliberalism, is not yet truly liberated. Too often, it remains shackled by developmentalism, by extractivism, unable to imagine an economic model that goes beyond nostalgia for a Keynesian or industrial socialist past. So too often, we remain stuck in old battles that we should have overcome by now, asking people to choose between jobs and the environment, poverty, or pollution. These false choices weaken and divide us, and we cannot afford that. Because our movements are not the only ones moving into the vacuum left by the collapse of neoliberal ideology. The shadow of the fascist right looms larger every day. From Trump to Le Pen, to the open racism of parts of the Brexit movement, and on and on. And if we want to win against the powerful seduction of that easy hatred, we will have to go deeper and further. That means more than just a list of demands, but a new story, a shared narrative, intersectional, integrated, and most of all, inspiring. I want to share with you an attempt that Roger mentioned that I've been involved in here in Canada, called the LEAP Manifesto. About 11 months ago, a group of us here in Canada launched this 1,400-word document. It came out of a meeting of 60 organizers, theorists, movement leaders from across the country. Roger was there. Clay was there. Many people in the room were there, part of drafting this. It was hard. It was difficult. But we created a space to dream, to not just agree on what we were against, but to think about the much better world that we could create. We asked ourselves the question, if we took the science of climate change seriously, how could we transition off of fossil fuels in that way that solved multiple crises at once? So we came up with this consensus document, and there was a thread running through it. And the thread was the need to move from an economy based on endless extraction, not just from the earth, but from workers' bodies, from our social safety net, of taking and taking as if there is no limit, as if there is no breaking point, to a culture of caretaking, of respecting the cycles of regeneration, of caring for one another and caring for the earth, of cherishing beauty, creation, each other, young and old. This shift is fundamentally a rejection of the sacrifice zone mentality that some people and some places count for less. So it begins by acknowledging the original caretakers of the land, water, and air. One of the key demands is the full implementation of the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People, something our current government says it is doing at the same time as it approves projects like the mega dam of Tsite Si, expressly opposed by Indigenous people who are impacted by it. One of the key demands of the LEAP is for energy democracy, that as we move from fossil fuels to renewables, we don't just want to be buying our solar panels from Exxon and Chevron. We want their money to pay for it in reparation for the damage that they have caused, but we want communities to own and control their own renewable energy projects. We were inspired by the incredible example of what Taggio has been involved in Germany, but we also wanted to go further. We want energy justice, which means that as we transition, we want to heal the wounds that date back to the founding of our country, which is why the LEAP states that Indigenous peoples and others on the front line of industrial activity should be first to receive public support for their own clean energy projects, that this needs to be policy. Points of unity, I'm almost out of time, but other points of unity that we found was connecting the treatment of the horrible treatment of migrants that this people at this forum have caught a glimpse of in this incredible double standard in the way visa applicants were treated. We acknowledge the role that our government has played in pushing people off of their lands, whether through illegal wars, whether through corporate trade deals, or whether through climate change itself. And as such, it calls for full rights for all workers, regardless of immigration status, and opening our borders to many more migrants and refugees. We call for big investments in green infrastructure, as you would imagine, right? Renewables, efficiency, transit, high-speed rail, all of that. We say these have to be union jobs paying a living wage, and we know that rather than fighting over the scraps of few jobs created over a pipeline, that these jobs in these sectors create 6 to 8 times more jobs than the ones created by the oil and gas industry. So we do that, and you would expect that from a consensus document about climate change. But the other thing we wanted to do was completely redefine what a green job is. Say green job, you imagine a guy with a hard hat putting up a solar panel. Great, we want those. But we also wanted to recognize the work of caretaking, the low-carbon sectors already out there that are not recognized as being climate jobs, the work of caring for the old, for the young, for the sick, of teaching other low-carbon sectors like the arts, public interest, media, the sectors that are under relentless attack by the logic of austerity. We say these are climate jobs. We say they need massive investments. And we know the money is out there. We have to go after it. That means an end to fossil fuel subsidies, another so far broken promise from the Trudeau government. Sorry for the non-Canadians, but I have to do this. Financial transaction taxes, increased royalties on fossil fuel extraction, higher income taxes on corporations and wealthy people, a progressive carbon tax, cuts to military spending, the polluter pays. Simple rule. Front lines first, polluter pays. Climate justice. No more of these crappy trade deals. We don't want any more of these trade deals. We want to renegotiate the ones that we have already signed that are standing in the way of meaningful climate action. And we want a national debate on a guaranteed annual income and whether that is a real solution to keep people from feeling like they have to take these jobs and there's no alternatives. The workers that are in those high-carbon sectors need to be democratically leading this transition, and they need the resources to be retrained to work in the low-carbon economy. So it's a lot. It's been endorsed by 200 organizations, very diverse, from Black Lives Matter Toronto to Oxfam, to Leonard Cohen, to Montrealer, Arcade Fire, another Montreal band. Little Montreal props, sorry. The corporate press has been understated. National suicide, I believe, was the one of our national newspapers called it madness. It was described as madness, this plan for a Canada based on caring for one another and the earth, by our national newspaper, The Globe and Mail. But the really exciting thing, since we put out this blueprint, this framework, this beginning of a plan, is the way it's been picked up and built on, particularly in the trade union movement. I was on a panel this morning with Mike Palachuk, who is the head of the Postal Workers Union here in Canada. And Mike talked about incredible union, just the, you know, the model of a visionary union. They are fighting for their lives. The post office is under threat of privatization, of massive cutbacks. Our previous government wanted to cancel mail delivery. And working with our team, the postal workers came up with a plan called Delivering Community Power that puts the post office at the center of a green transition. So the post office isn't just a place where you get the mail. It's also where you recharge your electric vehicles. The whole fleet would be transitioned to made in Canada electric vehicles. Postal banking, support for local green cooperatives, loans, solar panels on the roof, and doing more than delivering the mail, delivering local food and not doing door knocking for the elderly and being the center of the caring economy. This is how we need to think. And I'm so impressed with the postal workers because it shows that we can do more than just protect an unacceptable status quo. We can dream. We can dream of something better than we've ever tried before. So our corporate press has been freaking out. The political class also understated. The premier of British Columbia, right-wing premier, said that if the leap is implemented, hundreds of towns will literally be wiped off of the map. The premier of Saskatchewan said it's an existential threat. We thought that was climate change, but whatever. The exciting thing is people aren't spooked. They know this is where the future is. We understand right now that we have gone so far off course, and we have wasted so much time that now we're just on a precipice. There, we have so far that we need to go, and we have so little time to get there. And when you're in a situation like that, if you take a small step off that precipice, you fall in, right? And that's why small steps in this moment in history are not enough. Now is the time for boldness. Now is the time to leap. Thank you.
That was Naomi Klein. She spoke in August 2016 in Canada at the Grand Conference, Change the System, Not the Climate. She's best known for her book, This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate. That book tackles the most profound threat humanity has ever faced, the war our economic system is waging against life on Earth. Among her prior books are The Shock Doctrine and No Logo. Naomi Klein was one of the core group of activists who drafted the LEAP Manifesto in 2015. And you can read the text and add your name to the over 42,000 signatories. And you may see that it proves helpful where you live. Find links to Naomi Klein at the LEAP Manifesto on TUC Radio's website at tucradio.org. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio is free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gladden. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. This program is our second 2017 visit with ethnologist Dr. Victoria Patterson. We continue our discussion about how the native people of North America were initially treated by the United States and later during the westward expansion. Patterson describes the manner in which the Nez Perce Nation conducted themselves in the face of incredible adversity, which led to widespread admiration among their military adversaries and the American public. Led by Chief Joseph, the Nez Perce eventually retreated to Canada rather than being sent to reservations. She also discusses the consequences to the native people when they entered into written treaties with the United States. Not having a written language, the native people relied on the carefully chosen words they spoke during the treaty negotiations and the words spoken by the representatives of the United States. When my friend Vicki Patterson visited the Radio Curious studios on January 23, 2017, we began when she elaborated on and put into context the statement of Chief Joseph. It does not require many words to speak the truth.
One of the great disconnects between indigenous people in the United States and the Europeans who came later to settle here is the difference in culture and the use of language. All of the indigenous tribes prior to the 1830s were more or less oral cultures. And in an oral culture, what you say has tremendous power because speech is something that once it leaves your mouth, it's there. You can't take it back. And so you have to be very careful about what you say in oral tradition. And so many Indians were careful about what they said. When you have a culture that depends on writing, as the European culture did in terms of all these treaties and palavers and conversations, what came out of their mouths wasn't as important as what was written on a piece of paper. And so there was a lot of disconnect between the meaning of words. And, you know, we're... Recently in the news has been this term, the alternate facts. And of course, that's what happened, is that they were speaking from different universes with alternate facts, except in their case, you know, for Native people, what they were speaking was the truth and didn't need papers to write and change and distort what had come out of people's mouths. Because when you hear that in oral tradition, that's what you retain, what somebody said.
It's the only entry into the brain of knowledge transmitted by another person.
That's right. So I think that's what Chief Joseph meant. You don't need a lot of paper. You don't need a lot of conversation. You say what you mean after thinking carefully about what you're going to say. You know, we know the cliche, white man speak with forked tongue. Well, it's true. They said lots of things that they didn't mean and that they took back and that weren't the truth.
Or that may have varying meanings.
Yes, multiple meanings, yes. The doctrine of discovery is an example of an alternate fact, in a sense. It was a notion put forward by the Pope and by early European countries, especially Spain, during the Age of Discovery, where they declared that it was okay to colonize any non-Christian place on Earth. The Treaty of Tordesillas, which is the thing that divided the Atlantic between Spain and Portugal and allowed Portugal eventually to claim Brazil, was the sovereign action behind the papal bull, so to speak, that allowed them to colonize non-Christian lands. And unfortunately, this notion did not stick to the Age of Discovery. Justice Marshall, who we mentioned in connection with the Cherokee versus Georgia case, used it in that case to show that the Cherokee were a dependent nation, not an independent sovereign state. It was used in a case called Johnson versus McIntosh, where they had conflicting land claims. Johnson had inherited land that was purchased from Indians directly. That tribe subsequently sold the same piece of land and ended up in the U.S. government, and McIntosh bought it from the government. In that case, Marshall decided that McIntosh's claim was more valid because it came directly from the U.S. government. The U.S. government had the title to the land because they had discovered it, in quotes. So this notion of the doctrine of discovery is still used today. I think there was a case in 2005 where it was cited for an indigenous case in the United States.
And then, of course, the question is, discovered by whom,
well, yeah,
when,
because,
and where?
Exactly, because Native people were never consulted in any of these decisions or any of these treaties or any of these notions of discovery. They didn't exist. It was very racist and very ethnocentric.
Dr. Victoria Patterson, for people who are concerned about the rights of Native people in North America and other parts of the world, what would you suggest be done by them?
Well, I think one of the first steps is to get to know Native people, because so many of these decisions have been made without the input of the people about whom they are made. There have been always individuals who have stood up for Indian rights, who have protested to the government about injustice to Native people, but some of these have been misguided by their own notions about what Indians should be. For example, during the whole issue about Indian citizenship, there was a group of non-Indians who advocated for Indian citizenship, but their idea was to assimilate Indians into the larger mainstream society, and by making them citizens and able to vote, you know, they would become just like us. Well, many Indians don't want to become like us. And so they didn't really consult with Native people about what they wanted. And I think that's very important. And I think it's very inspiring to see how many non-Native people went to Standing Rock and stood with Native people and took direction from Native people about their role in the protest. I think that's very, very important. I think locally it's important to get to know Native people. You know, I have been working with these tribes for over 40 years, and although they are very welcoming at their big times for anybody to want to come, I don't see that many community people there. As the years have gone by, I've seen more and more attending, which is very heartening to see that people are getting to know their neighbor, so to speak. There are local issues that if you agree with the position of the tribe, you might want to participate in, like the Save the Little Lake Valley protests that have been going on. But I think the main thing is to let go of your ego and find out from your Native American neighbors what their concerns are, where they would like support, where they would need allies.
Let go of your ego is an interesting comment, because from the individual perspective of those of us who live here on the earth, the world revolves around each one of us. We see it from our own perspective. So to let go of that is extraordinary.
Yeah, but you can't see it from another perspective unless you do let go of your own and begin to see the world through other eyes. You know, part of my interest in ethnohistory has been the quest to understand this area where we live together from another perspective. And by looking at how language works and what the original names for some of the landmarks that we see around us, has been absolutely fascinating, because I begin to see this whole area with different eyes.
Can you give us some examples?
Well, to know the stories about how this part of the world was formed by the first people who lived on it tells me that there was a time when there were people there were beings who lived in this area who could do things then that we can only do in our dreams today. They could cover great distances with one step. They could change their shapes, and so on. And during this period of time, Coyote was living to the east of here, and he was very offended when the Wood Duck sisters refused to become his wives. And so he decided to take revenge, and he changed his shape into an old grandmother, invited these girls to go picking buckeye with him up in the mountains. And they went, he sort of attacked them, and they became pregnant and gave birth to children in the village, and the villagers were furious at Coyote, and they killed one of the children. He left his children while he went out hunting, but the villagers refused to feed them, which is really a shocking thing to do in those communities. And so he went further to the east, found a cave, and worked on it by stuffing it with tar and pitch and all kinds of wood until he one day set it on fire, ran back to the village and said, "Oh, there's a fire, there's a fire." And people were begging him, "Please help us, please help us." He said no. And then he disappeared, and he ran up. The world went on fire. He ran up to the top of what we call Red Mountain today and ascended to the sky with a magic quiver that he had and magic arrows. And to this day, that area is all red. And it's fascinating to know why. We call it Red Mountain. It was because it was scorched by this fire. After that, Coyote went to the coast. He started eating everything because everything was burned up, so there was a lot of roasted meat. And he ate everything, got very thirsty, went over to the coast, took a huge drinks of water from the ocean, and began to feel sick from drinking all the water and eating all the food. And so he kind of stumbled back east to where he lived. And he tripped and fell on his bloated stomach, and out came water, which formed Clear Lake. So these are fascinating stories to me because they explain a lot of actual geological changes. You know, the fact that he came towards the ocean, because we know that Blue Lakes at one time drained to the ocean, and then an earthquake came, or upheaval, volcanic upheaval came and changed the water course to the east. And so a lot of these ancient stories actually reflect true geological changes that occurred. But they also reflect on how people should behave to each other.
I'd like you to reflect more on how people should relate to each other using the examples that you've given. But first I want to say that in this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Dr. Victoria Patterson, an ethnologist who lives and works in Ukiah, California, the home of Radio Curious, and talking about the Native peoples and reflections on an address that she presented to the Ukiah community on January 22, 2017, entitled, "It Does Not Require Many Words to Speak the Truth." You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel.
So in this case, you know, Coyote, who has transgressed normal behavior in terms of what he did to those girls, is banished from his community, and so he takes revenge. But the end of the story is that eventually groups of people come to live around Clear Lake, and they form communities with captains or chiefs, and they begin to create a normal set of relationships between people. And this is an example of how a major transgression has caused a conflagration that burned up the earth. But they're given a second chance to come together and behave in a more moral way.
When you say normal relationships among people or behave in a
I mean
more
relationships
normal way.
Of respect and thoughtfulness about other people in a community.
But this is within the Pomo culture.
Yes, yes.
That lived in
ancient Pomo culture.
So can you describe in a time frame when this ancient time was and what was normal?
Well, you know, we're talking about a time that we don't have any direct knowledge of. We only have the memories of people whose memories come from the memories of their grandparents, whose memories come from the memories of their grandparents, and so on. Because archaeological evidence shows that Pomoan peoples have lived in this area in a settled way for a minimum of 10,000 years before present. And so we're talking about many, many, many memories. And so we can only glean what life was like during that time from those memories and from the things that people think are appropriate today in terms of their culture. But the culture has changed enormously due to many factors, due to modern technology, due to a history of post-traumatic stress syndrome brought about by the constant warfare and decimation of lives and land. And so you have a very different kind of culture today, although certain elements of that culture are still retained. The focus on family, the importance of family, is still very much in evidence in Pomoan groups today.
So if we were to go back in this section of North America, Northern California,
along the coast about 120 miles north of the San Francisco Bay. 180 years ago, there was no contact with European people. Can you describe for us the daily life and the daily life patterns as you've come to know them of the native people at that time?
And again, I have to say, this is not from direct knowledge, but it's from, you know, many ethnographies and people I've spoken to, but there's no way of knowing for sure what took place. But it seems as though people in this area were not part of huge tribes like the Sioux Nation or the Navajo Nation. They lived in small village communities, basically made up of extended families. And these groups didn't have an umbrella organization. They were not known as the Pomo. This is a term that has been placed on them by linguists and then ethnographers to describe a group of people who speak six mutually unintelligible but linguistically related languages. So you had these small village communities living in a resource-rich environment that enabled them to stay more or less in a small ecological niche, although they did exploit all of the avenues available to them. So people from this area, for example, used things from Clear Lake. They used things from the coast. But they didn't travel far from where they lived. And so people say, well, how come there's so many different languages if they, you know, stayed so isolated? How did they communicate? And they were able to communicate because many people were bilingual or trilingual. We don't think about that.
In other words, they spoke the language of their parents and the languages of their neighbors.
I've known people, elders, who spoke four or five languages. They spoke English, Spanish, Central Pomo, Eastern Pomo, and Northern Pomo.
Mickey Patterson, what happened to the original people of this area? Where do they live now and why?
Well, fortuitously, many of the descendants of the original Palmoan-speaking peoples of this area still live in their homelands. And this is really miraculous because so many tribes across the United States were removed from their homelands, you know, in the infamous Trail of Tears, forced to live thousands of miles from where they originated and from where their origin stories come from, where they were embedded in the soil of the land that they lived in. They were moved away. And this was extremely traumatic situation because if you lived in a place for 10,000 years, you really are of that place in terms of the food you've ingested and the lifestyle you've created and the relationship you have with everything around you, both spiritual and material. But here, because there wasn't any place to move them to, the rest of the United States have been taken up with other tribes. Reservations and rancherias were created for California Indians. And so they remain more or less in their original homelands, maybe not exactly on the acreage, but certainly in a familiar environment. That's very unique in U.S. Indian history.
Say more about becoming part of where your ancestors have lived for 10,000 years.
Well, I think about it
from an ethnological perspective.
Yeah, I think about it in terms of a family living in a house for generations. And if that family has lived in one house for generations, you know everything. You, as a child of that family, know everything about the house. You know, every crack in the wall, every creak in the floor. And you remember, you know, people tell you, oh, yeah, Uncle Joe was up in that room and Aunt Sylvia did this in that room and Grandma's recipes were really great. And so you know it intimately. Well, that's how people here knew this whole natural environment, that intimately. And some ethnographers have reported that they went to various places in Mendocino County with a Native person who hadn't been to that place for 25 years, and they knew exactly where the creek was, and they knew exactly where certain trees were, and they knew exactly where certain gathering spots were. And so to know a whole environment as intimately as we might know a house held for generations is really quite something. And when that time span has been thousands of years, not 100 or 200, but thousands, you can understand how intimately people become part of their environment.
There's a book entitled Deep Valley that provides a description of this part of California, the small valley where Ukiah is in Mendocino County in Northern California. Can you talk briefly about Deep Valley?
Yes, Deep Valley was a book written by a man named Aginsky, who was a sociologist from New York, whose family was very wealthy. They had a very wealthy construction company. They built a lot of buildings, and he became sort of an avocational sociologist. He had been at Columbia University, but developed this idea of creating a project that would look at a rural community over a period of time and see the changes, mark the changes in social relationships between elements of that community. He picked Ukiah, and he started a field project that came to Ukiah every year for over 10 years with a multidisciplinary team of researchers, a group of students. It was a project funded by the University of Syracuse, and the students were master's degree students, and they were assigned to study various aspects of this rural community. So it's to produce a snapshot of a rural community over a period of time. So from about 1934 to 1947, with a small hiatus during the Second World War. So he had someone who was interested in agriculture, and they examined all the agriculture. He had someone interested in mineralogy. They studied, you know, geology and mineral formations. They came and they talked to all kinds of people in Ukiah. They divided Ukiah into a variety of ethnic groups. There were the Italians, there were the townspeople, and there were the Indians. And so they were looking at the relationships of these people with each other and with other groups of people in the area. So in that project, Aginsky and his students interviewed many Indians, especially from the Ukiah area. And his students later on became fairly well-known ethnologists, and they produced their own work about Indians in this area. Anyway, it was a remarkable project, and based on those interviews, Aginsky decided to write a fictionalized account. This is a fictionalized account, Deep Valley, of what life might have been like in the Ukiah Valley just on the eve of contact. In other words, in his book, the local Indians hear about the Spanish in the Sonoma area, and they talk about, you know, they talk about rumors they've heard of these newcomers. So he tries to recreate, based on his interviews, a picture of Native life prior to white contact in Mendocino and Lake counties.
And that's Deep Valley by Bert and Ethel Aginsky. Dr. Victoria Patterson, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I want to ask about you. And the first question is about a eureka or an aha moment that changed your view of the world and perhaps consequently your life.
I did have one. I had a vision, possibly under the influence of other substances, that was very clear. It was a kind of sort of dream or reverie where it seems really real, where whatever occurs seems like it's really happening. And this was a vision of a young boy, a native boy, probably in the Southwest, because it was like a desert environment. And he was laying sticks on the ground in a square, each stick positioned very carefully in the square. And this vision came with a title to it. And I had been doing a lot of work with Native people, and so it came with sort of a Native name. And the name of the boy in this vision was He Does It Right. And I suddenly understood that there was an order to the way people did things. And there was only a right way and a not right way. And it enabled me to understand sort of Native ritual and Native beliefs, and that there was a right way to do things. And so that really influenced my understanding and pushed me in the direction of continuing looking at Native people and working with them.
Well, you've done that for over 40 years. And my next question is, what would you like to do with the remainder of your one precious life?
Well, I have a lovely granddaughter who I'd like to spend as much time with as possible. But I also like to travel because I love seeing how other people live. some years ago, well, not too long ago, I went and lived in Ecuador for a year teaching at the University of Cuenca because I wanted to live in a Spanish-speaking culture as a participant in the culture, not only as a visitor. And so I had that opportunity, and it was a wonderful experience. I would like to do that again, but I'm not sure where. But I've been taking a lot of the small trips here and there, and I'm just fascinated by how other people live in the world.
And finally, Vicki Patterson, is there a book that you can recommend to our listeners?
Well, because of my interest in other people, I've been reading, the most recent book I read is a collection edited by Bill Bryson on the best travel stories of 2016. And these are not the kind of things you might find in a travel magazine, like this is the best hotel or this is the best restaurant. They're more people's experiences in a different place or a place different to them. And so it's quite fascinating. And the stories range from teenage surfing off Diamond Head to cigarette smuggling in Eastern Europe. So it's a very enjoyable collection.
Well, Dr. Vicki Patterson, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Thank you again for having me.
Dr. Victoria Patterson is an ethnologist who has studied the native people of what is now the United States for the past 40 years. She lives and works in Ukiah, California. You may enjoy our 1999 two-part series with Dr. Patterson about the Pomo people of Northern California prior to contact with Europeans and then again 10 years after. These programs are found on radiocurious.org by searching for Patterson. The book that Victoria Patterson recommends is The Best American Travel Writing, 2016, by Bill Bryson. This program was recorded on January 23, 2017. There are now over 630 archive editions on Radio Curious. That's radiocurious.org. They're free for you to enjoy, download, and share as you wish. We appreciate your cards, letters, and ideas about our programming and look forward to hearing from you. 280 North Oak, Ukiah, California, 95482, 707-462-6541. Angie Boyles Askham is the assistant producer. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.